Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit grey today, isn't it?
Well, hello everyone. I'm here. Welcome to another Deepest Lore. I've got Pepsi Max with ice cubes today. What are you drinking, D?
Pepsi Max? How dare you? I've got a Coke Zero Sugar Cherry.
Oh, so there we go. Are you all revved up to talk about Bowie Part 2?
Indeed.
I did a stream last night, D, which has now been age-restricted because...
Yeah. Because I watched it, yeah.
Because of my discussion of a certain certain pork mince dish with which is served with mushy peas. I've appealed it to YouTube because they restricted it for nudity. I was like, well, nudity and sexual, overly sexual and vulgar language. I was like, well, where was that then?
You know, I thought they were more afraid of terrifying children with images of a rissole.
So. I should mention the summer sale started yesterday as well. Get ready. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code SCORCHER. 25% off all courses. SCORCHER. Get it now. SCORCHER. 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 Promo code SCORCHER. 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 Buy it now. All right.
I mean, Scorcher.
Do you think it was that woman who does the pop who they thought is that the scantily clad? Is that the nudity they were on about? Or do you know, Daughter of Albion was saying she was looking out for bits of accidental partridge from me. I wonder if that promo is it.
It may be. Scorcher.
Yeah, so do get that. Anything you'd like to promote before we get going?
No.
All right. So let us. I will mention one thing. Something extraordinary happened on that stream last night. Extraordinary, which is that Drongo gave away 50 channel memberships. And I don't know how this works or what the mechanism for doing that is, but. It was incredible, and he did it as I was closing the stream, so I actually missed that it was happening.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was so angry because I have wanted a channel membership for literally years since you instated them.
I was looking around last night, and I do not have the capacity to give away. No. I'll give you one, D. But apparently, somebody else has to buy you one. So
yeah, no. Because I'm just not going to give any information to Google, so I can't buy one. It's a bit like Twitch. I think Twitch has long had this thing where someone in the audience can gift subs. So that was a big thing. So I suppose YouTube is trying to inch closer to that.
Also, because he did that, I was able to update the. It took me over some threshold, and I was able to update the badges that people get. So now you get badges at 36 and months and at 48 months as well. So you can actually go beyond Pinochet. I won't reveal who is lurking there.
Who is it?
Who's at the vet? Who do you get to at 48 months?
But was he a painter?
No. I don't think they would allow that. But it'll be a little surprise for when people get there. Okay. So where were we? We got basically to Hunky Dory last week, and This week, we're going to concentrate on what are typically called the Ziggy years. That is Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, and Pinups. And then, of course, he broke up the band and retired at Hammersmith, famously. So we'll talk about that a bit as well. But for obvious reasons, we're going to spend a bulk of this time on the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. Now, I was thinking about, because at the end of this, I want to rank all the albums D, and a lot of people, like, my instincts are towards not giving it to Ziggy because it seems very mainstream. But yes. I have to say, driving to the lodge last night, I just put it on full blast. And I was like, fucking hell, this is an amazing album. Is
it I don't know if you've ever seen the vinyl of the Rise and Fall, etc. But there is printed in all capitals on the, I believe it's on the back of the, I don't have mine at hand, but it says to be played at maximum volume, which was on the original pressing.
But it's probably the first time I listened to it start to finish in a few years. And it just blew me away how good it is. There's not a moment, basically, that is wasted on the album, in my opinion. Unlike Hunky Dory, which I do think has a couple of kind of weaker tracks, I just don't think there's a weak moment on the whole album. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with you. I don't think there is. I don't think there's any miss on Ziggy Stardust. I don't think it's the best Bowie record. It's not. I wouldn't make it number one, but it's certainly up there. I would say it's pretty much flawless, and there's a lot going on in it that I think people perhaps don't realize. So
yeah, no, do you remember I said I had two Bowie guides? There were one by David Buckley and one by Nicholas Pegg. I have now found my David Buckley book. He basically goes through every single track, every single album. But his entries are all a bit snide. You know, he's just got kind of like one little paragraph on each song. So I'll come to that later. But this Nicholas Pegg book, The Complete David Bowie, starts off with a very interesting passage about what this album was trying to do, what Bowie thought he was trying to do. And I thought I would actually read it in full, D, because it has a lot of crossover with the stuff we discussed on the famous 8-part Warhol series. I'd just be interested to know what you think of it. So he says, "The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars was Bowie's first hit album and his ticket to superstardom. The central conceit, a visionary poet who, with a little extraterrestrial assistance, becomes a rock star in a world teetering on the brink of apocalypse, was an exotic consummation of Bowie's lifelong absorption of disparate elements of the zeitgeist. Andy Warhol, Little Richard, Mark Bolan, Lou Reed, Iggy Pop, T.S. Eliot, Christopher Isherwood, Pork, A Clockwork Orange, Metropolis, 2001, Quatermass and the Pit, all went into the melting pot." What a ridiculous collection of names that is.
It is, but strangely enough, I would agree with probably almost all of those. Yeah, I mean, many of them, Bowie actually explicitly stated that in various interviews. But yes, it is a strange mixture.
Bowie described it as a cross between Nijinsky and Woolworths. That was how David described the juxtaposition.
I remember that.
High art and delicious banality embodied in Ziggy Stardust. Now, for American listeners, Woolworths was like this kind of, I think it closed down like 10, 15 years ago. But when I was a kid, it was a shop that sold like pick and mix toys. And
yeah, America had them as well.
Did they?
It was originally an American company. I think it was, and I think they're still going in like in Australia in some form.
Yeah, and Nijinsky, of course, is a ballet thing, right? Is that right?
Yeah, Nijinsky was a impresario of ballet. Yeah.
Says Yes. So anyway, this was how David described the juxtaposition of high art and delicious banality embodied in Ziggy Stardust, a character who pushed new extremes. Bowie's fascination with the nature of celebrity. The work achieved its fullest expression on stage, where outlandish costumes, makeup, mime, pantomime, commedia dell'arte, and kabuki theatre crystallized in a thrilling exploration of the artificial relationship between performer and audience. It's no surprise that Ziggy Stardust was a success, David later explained. I packaged a totally credible plastic rock and roll singer, much better than the Monkees could ever fabricate. I mean, my plastic rock and roller was much more plastic than anybody's, and that was what was needed at the time. For a while, in late 1972 and early 1973, Bowie and Ziggy were practically indistinguishable from one another. Part of the album's enduring mystique is the self-mythologizing pretensions of the songs themselves. I could make a transformation as a rock and roll star, so inviting, so enticing to play the part. Operate as a parallel enactment of the process that simultaneously launched Bowie himself as a major artist. You listen to the album, and he wrote about desiring stardom, photographer Mick Rock observed 30 years later. He had stars in his eyes and on his mind for sure. He was projecting heavily before it actually happened. That's the fascinating part. How prescient he was, because it did all come to pass. In retrospect, he knew. He had an acute sense of the moment, and he wrote it brilliantly. It was during the early stages of the Ziggy Stardust campaign that, with the encouragement of Tony DeFreese, do you remember from last week, DeFreese replaced Kenneth Pitt, do you remember? David began to live out the main man nostrum that in order to become a star, one must learn to behave like one. Publicists were hired to ensure that the doors were always held open for him. He had a bodyguard and travelled everywhere by limousine. Photography was controlled and plans laid to restrict press access to David himself. And all that time, when to the majority of the record-buying public, David Bowie was nobody, Tony DeFreese had this idea that if we just told the world I was super huge and then treated me as though I were, then something might happen, David later explains, and we know that DeFreese was right. Now, reading that, I mean, sorry to bring this up, Dee, but I cannot help but think about pro wrestling yet again. Because, I mean, last night Ric Flair had his last match, believe it or not. Well, one of the things that Ric Flair was famous for was spending his own money on private jets, limousines, buying all the drinks at the bar. Basically, if he presented himself as an absolute superstar, people would buy into the idea that he was one. They did a very similar thing actually with the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase. You know, they gave him a limousine. You know, basically act like a big shot wherever you go, and people will basically buy into this idea that you're already a huge star. But here was Bowie doing it in the 70s in a very different context, and it just strikes me that you know, when I say like pro wrestling is real life, there is an element of this, like just LARP as a rock star and basically you'll just become one.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an aphorism by Oscar Wilde. I don't know the exact wording, but it's something like the first goal in life is to assume a pose. The second hasn't yet been discovered. You know, I mean, I certainly think that ethos, which we would sort of now identify as a kind of proto-postmodernism. Yeah, I think it runs through all these people. It was the same with Warhol. I mean, my friend Panama Hat often jokes that I have the secret plan where all of the things that I sort of talk about and introduce to various younger people, they're all connected in some grand, you know, sort of, I have a pinboard on my wall with all the connections drawn out. But it's true. I mean, I think there is, and with you as well, I think we both have a sort of innate admiration for artifice in one way or the other.
Yeah, well, as pretty much the one of the major kind of themes of the 20th century, really, it was the, you know, it was a century of many other things too, but a century of artifice or of surfaces and image. But let's see what we're, because there's some interesting bits here about what he thought he was doing himself and how he thought of himself versus certain so-called glam stars who came a bit later. Because it's quite interesting. He says, this appropriation of a specific set of behavioral conventions in order to manipulate the real world would become a template for Bowie's career. Before Ziggy Stardust, his work as a songwriter and performer, however experimental, had maintained a monolithic aspect, a conventional view of the artist as Olympian observer at the center of a creative web of assimilated influences and abilities. After Ziggy Stardust, Bowie, like Warhol, would achieve the status of a postmodern artifact, a blank canvas, styling his creative output in response to the shifting sands of fashion and experience. I'm really just a photostat machine, he told journalists in 1973. I pour out what has already been fed in. I merely reflect what is going on around me.
Literally paraphrases of things that Warhol said a decade earlier. Amazing. I never heard that.
Thus, in the music of Ziggy Stardust, which rarely comes first in any discussion of the mythology built up around the album, it is a vigorous restatement of the three-minute pop perfected by Bowie's childhood heroes of the 1950s, filtered through the electric soundscape of the early 1970s. It is an eloquent plea for the pop song in all its gimcrack cheapness as a valid art form and an energetic dismissal of the increasingly pompous quest for neoclassical sophistication in rock. So, I mean, is he referring there to the prog pioneers who would have been around at this time? What is this neoclassical sophistication he's talking about?
I don't know exactly. I'm trying to think.
ELO around at this time, yeah? Or?
A bit. I don't know, because I don't think you could call any of the kind of sort of prog people of this era neoclassical, really.
Renaissance, Ashes of Burning, when did that come out? That's kind of. I'm just trying to think of like what is he getting at? But anyway, Bowie's red hair, makeup, and space age costumes were more than just an eye catching gimmick, although of course they were that too, and they did their job well. Ziggy's multi-referential appearance circumscribed its own superficiality, injecting a sense of exotic decadence and pantomimic ritual into a popular culture dominated by the t-shirts and jeans norm of progressive rock. Glam was about cherishing uncertainty, anxiety, and change, and it did so via a heady combination of nostalgia and futurism. It's a common mistake, as it is with any creative school, to assume that glam was some kind of movement. He's put that in inverted commas. But if there was one consistent aim, it was the diversification of culture and the dismantling of tribal allegiances. Bowie asserts that he and other glam pioneers, like Roxy Music, attempted to broaden rock's vocabulary. We were trying to include certain visual aspects in our music, grown out of the fine arts, and real theatrical and cinematic leanings. In brief, everything which was on the exterior of rock. As far as I was concerned, and this is Bowie still speaking, I introduced elements of Dada, an enormous amount of elements borrowed from Japanese culture. I think we took ourselves for avant-garde explorers, the representatives of an embryonic form of postmodernism. The other type of glam rock was directly borrowed from the rock tradition, the weird clothes and all that. To be quite honest, I think we were very elitist. I can't speak for Roxy Music, but as far as I'm concerned, I was a real snob. I believe that there were two kinds of glam, one high and the other situated lower, and I think we were more in the first category. And then later on, he lays into one of these lower glam acts, The Sweet, if you can remember them.
Yeah.
He says, whatever came out of the early 70s music that had any longevity to it generally had a sense of humour underlying it. The suite were everything that we loathed. They dressed themselves up as early 70s, but there was no sense of humor there. There was no real sense of irony about what we were doing. I remember saying at the time that rock must prostitute itself, and I'll stand by that. If you're going to work in a whorehouse, you'd better be the best whore in it. So, I mean, that's a pretty big swipe at the suite there. And I'm guessing he has in mind other acts like Wizard and Slade and all those other kind of groups that came a little bit later. Because I think by the time that those guys were hitting the scene, Bowie had already called rock a toothless old woman and was doing Young Americans and stuff, wasn't he? So, so yeah, any thoughts on that passage? I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with a lot of that. I think that Bowie I think the thing is that a lot of people, you know, one thing that I've always been irritated by people, there's a certain segment of Bowie fans who sort of, you know, again, they embrace the kind of trappings of each of these kind of periods. You know, if you're a sort of glam rock fan, you're like, oh, I adore the, you know, the makeup and the costumes and the camp and such. But I don't, in a weird way, I don't think Bowie was really interested in that at all. I mean, given that he very quickly dropped it once it was no longer useful to him, you know. And I think that that may be the kind of differentiation between him and the way he used this as a, you know, as a style, you know, people who sort of took it too seriously. And Roxy Music did the same thing. I mean, they sort of embraced it as a kind of a pose, but very quickly, when it had been used up, they moved on. And certain people weren't able to do that. You know, Mark Bolan, I would say, as of T-Rex, as good as he was, I don't think he could really break himself out of the style of the times. And I think that was great frustration. So.
Yeah, there's also a really hilarious passage about his famous I'm gay interview here. And you'll see why it's hilarious when I read it. Inevitably, reactions to the I'm gay interview were inconsistent and far-reaching. There were those who condemned Bowie's stance in reactionary terms. Later, the same year, Cliff Richard denounced him as being instrumental in the disintegration of society's moral fiber.
Stop it.
So I just
oh,
just the fact that it was Cliff Richard.
That's... Oh, that's irony hitting you like a speeding truck.
He says, in America, a country famously ill at ease with any concept of irony, and that's true. That's true to this day. I mean, I don't know if you know, you've traveled America as I have, but there's something I noticed, which is that if you ever hear Bowie on the radio in America, it's always Golden Years. It's always from that period. It's Golden Years, or it's Young Americans, or some, maybe it's Let's Dance, but it's seldom, if ever, his Ziggy era stuff on the radio. I'm talking about on the classic rock stations and so on. I remember traveling America. I must have heard Golden Years about 10 times in different places.
Yeah. I remember Fame was also used in that way.
Fame, yeah. Yes, that's another one that they'd play. Trying to think of any other. You don't really hear anything outside of those.
Not really, no. Okay. I mean, Changes would get some play occasionally, but
Anyway, so, but it's also true that Americans struggle with irony, which is one of those things that it's hard to quantify, because Americans can be really sarcastic and cussing and things like that. But irony, I really think that there's a reason why on their TV shows they have to like really lay out when there's a joke. You know, this is the bit where you're meant to laugh. They don't get certain things, and I've just discovered that through just years of presenting shows on the internet and seeing what they don't get, you know. I kind of like that. I like the fact that it's never quite clear if I'm being serious or not, because Americans struggle with it, and I like to play with it. So,
well, I think, and actually, I think that's one of the good things about Americans. I think that kind of distinction, you know, that kind of subtle distinction is one of the charms. You know, I mean, you know, it's funny to say that, of course, because you know, you've got a whole civilization that has been overtaken by irony and its, you know, and its various mechanisms, and yet, you know, they also don't realize it. You know, I mean, they live in a constant state of irony, cynical irony,
yeah.
And yet
Yeah,
they
that
don't,
is true.
they can't recognize it. You know,
isn't that ironic, don't you think? Anyway.
God's sake.
Anyway.
Oh, Cliff Richard and Alanis Morissette.
Most Bowie coverage now began and ended with the question of his sexuality. In America, this is. While a few American performers of the 1970s who sought to emulate Bowie, like the entertaining but forgettable Jobwraith, I've never even heard of him.
Talk about forgettable. I've never heard of him.
Did so with a stiflingly gay context. As late as 1976, many American critics still regarded David primarily as a gay icon, which is unsurprising, given that Cherry Vanilla, main man publicity officer, had swamped the press with enthusiastic and lurid details of David's sexual adventures in advance of his first US tour in 1972. So one of the great ironies is, right, when we're doing this series, we're flooded with stories of Bowie's degeneracy, like, oh, did he sleep with Mick Jagger and all this? Little do they know that they're literally repeating press stunts from 1972, like
1972.
Literally marketing stunts being repeated back to us. It's kind of, it is really kind of incredible. But anyway, as the occasional hostile reception to the tour demonstrated, America was not yet ready for homosexuality as a marketing strategy. Alice Cooper had to stop wearing ladies' sling black back shoes and false eyelashes and dresses and get more into horror, remarked Jane County later. People could understand horror and blood and dead babies, but they couldn't understand male-female sexuality and androgyny, or, as little American boys would say, fag music. Bowie later intimated that he had disapproved of Cherry Vanilla's tactics from the start. All the time that was going on, I was in another country, so it was very hard for me to keep any sort of control. When I got to America and found out how I'd been set up, I thought, my God, I can't fight this enormous snowball. I'll have to work with it and gradually push it down into something more manageable. In some quarters, it would take until 1983's China Girl video for the skeptics to concede that David Bowie might not be the raving queen that he had once cracked himself up to be. I just thought that was, an interesting passage, given that this stuff still rages on. So, yes, what do you think? And then there's another bit about how gay lib activists try to embrace Bowie in the summer of 1972. Gay News welcomed him as probably the best rock musician in Britain, a potent spokesman for something called gay rock. But Bowie's long-standing refusal to politicize himself or be a cause for anyone, a presentation he had long ago made to Kenneth Pitt, inevitably resulted in some of the flag wavers experiencing a misplaced sense of betrayal when he turned out not to be everything they had projected onto him.
And Judas!
This is not to deny the impact of Bowie's projection of the gay sensibility before the mainstream pop audience, which was positively seismic, blah, blah, blah. So I just think that it's just worth bearing in mind that he's playing with this character. But a lot of the mythos around it was launched by this bloody main man company as a US marketing strategy, which Bowie actively resented. So I didn't actually know that until I read it in this book. So did you know any of that?
Yeah, I was aware of that. I mean, I've certainly followed the narrative of Bowie being a kind of traitor, you know, a kind of pioneering traitor. The damp squib of you know, the promise of the queer future, you know, that has been going around for a very long time. So
with all of that said, shall we now hit the record. What do you want to talk about? The individual songs?
Yes, yes. I mean, first of all, we need to do a little bit of background. I mean, I think most people don't realize that all of the songs, or most of the songs on The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, which I will henceforth just call Ziggy Stardust, they're not aware that those songs were all written at the same time as Hunky Dory. I mean, all of those songs came from that same period. And Ziggy Stardust as a record was never planned. I mean, the songs on it were never sort of part of that program. That program was basically made up afterward, and then there was some modification to the songs, and there was some attempt to kind of contextualize them and perform a you know, and sort of order them in a way that made sense. But that it's not a rock opera. It's not a concept album, really. It's a kind of quasi concept album, but that was all kind of imposed upon this collection of songs after the fact. So when you sort of keep that in mind, when you listen to them, you can certainly hear in many of the songs, you can hear the sort of connections to the the Hunky Dory period, because like I said, they all came from there, or most came from there. So yes, I mean, this, again, I think people misunderstand Ziggy Stardust as being, you know, of course, that trend of the kind of concept album became really big in the 70s, you know, and all the prog people did it, certainly, you know, Jethro Tull, I mean, yes.
In my experience, the best sort of concept albums are loose concept albums, not one where they try to impose a narrative, because they inevitably fail or become tiresome. I mean, I have in mind, you know, some of Pink Floyd's later efforts.
Pink Floyd,
even the Kinks, who we'll talk about, when they made their foray into narrative form, or even the Who. I mean,
one of the worst offenders. I mean, again, there's some great tracks on Quadrophenia and
I'm trying to think of a single narrative concept album that works, and the only one I would point to that I would be comfortable saying, oh yeah, that's a good album, and is War of the Worlds, the Richard Burton Jeff Wayne album. But that's kind of a soundtrack as well, right? Or it's kind of like a narrative.
Yeah,
I mean,
I know you don't. You're not a big prog fan, but I am. I mean, I've been a huge fan of a lot of the British prog rock from the 70s for a very long time. So, you know, one of the things I consider kind of successful concept albums, like Genesis's The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, or Jethro Tull's Thick as a Brick, or Passion Play, or even like, you know, Gentle Giant. I mean, these are all very sort of, I would say, slightly niche efforts, and they are, I would say they are what you say. They're very kind of esoteric or loose concept. They are not kind of narratives in the traditional sense. I think the sort of narrative records are the worst. I mean, Tommy is just intolerable to me, even though there's a few good songs on it, but I can't stand that sort of, you know, and unfortunately, you know, Bowie was tempted by it. I mean, he did for a while in I think 1973 entertain the idea of making Ziggy Stardust into a musical, which would have been a disaster.
In fact, the only strongly narrative concept album he ever did was One Outside, which we'll get to, from 1995.
You'll have to fill that in.
I should mention, by the way, that I'm a fan of Thick as a Brick, but I don't really regard that as a narrative album.
No, it's not. I mean, there is a thread. I mean, of course, it's two tracks. You know, it's side one and side two, so it's not really, it's difficult to separate that into songs. But yeah, I mean, I do tend to also like things, and Gentle Giant did the same thing. King Crimson, in a weird way, would do sort of quasi concept albums, but yeah, never the sort of narrative Ford. I mean, Bowie's closest record, I think Diamond Dogs was very consciously planned as a kind of narrative stage show, and that was how the tour, you know, the concerts were set up like that. But again, the record doesn't really come across that way either. So.
Well, we meet we'll come to that next time. But we meet Halloween Jack in the opener, and then we don't see him again.
Yeah,
and it's all just like 1984 themed songs and
yeah, you know, the Orwellian sort of flavored things. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So it starts with 5 years.
5 years. Yes. So the record, I mean, so as far as the, I mean, if you could say there's a concept, I mean, there was a sort of, a loose concept to this. And the concept, I mean, you sort of mentioned it, which is that Ziggy Stardust was this character who was sort of either from another dimension, you know, and sort of born again as a human, or he was sort of a human possessed by this extraterrestrial character who was sent to save mankind, because 5 years sets up the tone of the record as being set in a world that has just found out that it's going to end in 5 years. I mean, that's what the song is about. And there's a whole apocalyptic narrative that goes through Ziggy Stardust, goes through all of Bowie in a weird way. I mean, that's a theme that comes up in the game.
I don't think, by the way, because it's mentioned elsewhere in this book that you know, the phone box on the cover is a clear reference to Doctor Who. You know, you know, they mentioned Quatermass and the Pit and Day of the Triffids and things like that. I don't think you can underestimate the influence of like really kind of ropey British sci-fi.
And it was absolutely Bowie, there. You know, yeah, it was absolutely there. I mean, the Quatermass. There was some speculation that there's elements from the Three Doctors episode of Doctor Who that there's a sort of some influence on Ziggy Stardust. By the way, I have to correct you. There's no call box on the cover of.
It's on the back, isn't it? It's on the back.
On the back, yes.
Okay. Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant, you know.
Also,
we should mention the name comes from... So the name is an amalgam, the Ziggy Stardust name.
Yeah, and that's another one of those weird Bowie kind of histories, because he's given multiple accounts of what it actually means. I mean, the one he gave at the time was that he was on a train, and he looked out and he saw a tailor, you know, a tailor's shop called Ziggy's. And he said he just thought it was perfect because it reminded him of course, Iggy Pop, who he was infatuated with at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also it was a Christian name that began with a Z, which he liked. So that was the story, but he has given other accounts of where that came from. And Stardust, as far as anyone can tell, is from the name of a fellow called Norman Odom, who was called the legendary Stardust Cowboy, who's still about. I don't know that he performs occasionally, and he was Bowie quite liked him. He's kind of an outsider.
I include, if you go back to the AA Gold DJ Velvet Glove sessions, on what I included a legendary Stardust Cowboy song, I Took a Trip on Your Gemini Spaceship.
Oh, okay.
because Bowie later covers it, and I thought it would be fun to play the original track. And he was actually one of those kind of novelty acts. He was, in fact, he wasn't a novelty act, but he was booked like one.
He was booked like one.
And this is a really nasty story, actually. He says, the legendary Stardust Cowboy, his renown was largely based on being booked for an ironically awful appearance on Rowan and Martin's Laughing.
Oh.
They all laughed at him and he walked off and cried, said David. So, he was booked. Like, they booked him on TV basically just to laugh at him, even though he he wasn't going for that, but yeah, they still treated him like that anyway.
It's a bit like Tiny Tim. I mean, Tiny Tim embraced it. He embraced the kind of, you know, idea that people were laughing at him. But again, I think it was another example of someone who, you know, was really deeply outside of any kind of mainstream idea of music, who was then, you know, who then found their little inroad to more popular celebrity through mockery, basically.
Yeah, it's also worth mentioning, by the way, that this figure of the slightly messianic rock star who has a meteoric rise and then an equally meteoric or a catastrophic fall, clearly has a lot of like real life, you know, Sid Barrett,
Vince Taylor, who was another favorite of Bowie.
Jim Morrison, you could add, Janis Joplin,
Hendrix,
Brian Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many of them. You know, you could later add Mark Bolan. Even after this point, Mark Bolan was kind of like a real life Ziggy.
Yeah.
John
Lennon, post Ziggy, but yeah.
So it's clearly something that, it's clearly like a real phenomenon that happens, even though he's made this kind of alien character to tell the story through.
He then sort of like infuses it with, of course, you know, the kind of figure of a messiah of Christ. You know, he sort of transforms this tawdry, you know, idea of a person, you know, thrust into fame who destroys himself, you know.
Can I just say, by the way, you know that photographer Mick Rock?
Yeah.
He has tons of, like, he obviously is one of these people who likes to give a lot of interviews and things. Yeah. But some of the stuff he said, right? Mick Rock: if David Bowie was the Jesus Christ of glam, then Mark Bolan was John the Baptist. Just shut up. Why? So I'm just saying that.
Like, why you listen to Mick Rock? I mean, it's funny thing, of course.
Consider the scene around these people, though, and the sort of shit they said as well.
Sort of crap. Yeah, I mean, Mick Rock, you know, in all fairness, took basically every picture, you know, from the late 60s, early 70s, that they're all his. I mean, all these pictures of Bowie are almost the Mick Rocks, but still, yeah, I mean, just take the pictures and shut up, mate.
I'm just saying that as he's mythologizing Ziggy, he is getting mythologized in real time by people like Mick Rock, both through his work, but also through like cringe, ridiculous lines like that.
Which he hated. I mean, you know, it was very clear, and very clear that he really, you know, through each of these sort of transformations. Now, speaking of the Doctor Who thing, I mean, you know, he did sort of have a regeneration. Like the Doctor, so,
yeah, or like the original Roland Rat, who's had many regenerations. Okay, so right, 5 years.
Now, so 5 years. So 5 years.
I want to say something controversial, D, before we start,
uh-oh,
which is that as strong as Ziggy is as a record, okay, and I'm sure Bowie himself would have admitted this when he was alive as well. I believe that even though the songwriting is exceptionally strong, the band is really good, the music is great, the lyrics are great on the record. In terms of Bowie's vocal performance, there is this kind of reedy quality. Like, I mean, I was thinking about this as I was listening to it yesterday. I was thinking, well, Bowie doesn't really hit his peak as a vocalist, in my opinion, until probably like Lodger, Scary Monsters era, because his voice drops an octave. And so, you know, when he goes low and then he can go high, and he's got like a really massive range. We talked about Fantastic Voyage last week briefly, or on, you know, like, what's that song? Look Back in Anger, you know, it starts low, you know, it kind of can go many places. Even on the Berlin albums, he's got that range that he can go to. Whereas on this album,
Richie was an angel.
on 5 years and on the whole album, really, he does sound a bit kind of just young. Like his vocal is reedy and kind of high and not quite, it's again, the kind of slightly shrill quality to the vocal line that, I mean, you know, it all works. I'm not saying it's a bad album or anything. I'm just saying it's something that I noticed when I was listening to it.
I would agree with you and yet completely disagree with you. I mean, yes, you're absolutely right that there was a huge change that sort of began, I'd say, right after this period and then, you know, reached its peak late in the 70s. But I love the fact that the vocals on this record are in this the beginning of this transitional period, because I think that as wonderful a vocalist as he was, I do think that there's something about that, the sort of his use of vibrato and the timbre and of his, you know, the colors of his voice, that I don't know, I think he can get a little bit heavy, a little much, depending upon what he was doing. So I quite like the sound.
Apparently Bowie, Bowie himself, I didn't know this, I'm just noting, I'm spotting it as we're talking. Bowie himself, at different times in his later life, had different attitudes towards Ziggy himself. So in 1990, he was going through a bit of a period where he wasn't a fan of it. He was saying, I find the Ziggy Stardust record very thin. It sounded really powerful then. Maybe systems have got better, but it sounds kind of weedy to me. That's what he was saying. That's what he was saying in 1990. But
yeah, clearly, I think he's probably talking about the sound of the record, not his own performances. And I do think that I mean, he was right in a way. There's a 2013 remaster in which the record, you know, the record really sounds very, very different, and it really needed a bit of a boost. But I think it's, I don't know, I quite like his voice in this, but I think that's just a matter of taste.
So someone in the chat is saying that the nasally voice is deliberate, and he imitated it in a 1980 performance of Life on Mars, apparently, that he went back to doing that. So
it's possibly true, because he did change his, he would occasionally change his vocal color, you know, for effect in certain songs.
I was thinking about this before, and I was thinking, like, where are the shades of the later Bowie voice, the kind of signature Bowie voice that we're talking about before this point? And I was thinking that it's there on Space Oddity. If it's anywhere, he has that. There are shades of the vocalist he would become on Space Oddity as a record.
But, do you have any specific?
Just the way he sounds, because he's got that early Anthony Newley kind of Mockney voice that he uses. Then he's got the voice that we see on this record and Hunky Dory. But on Space Oddity, I don't know. I don't know if it's because the vocal is layered and there's several different vocal tracks on there. But to me, he sounds most like he would later on that record, early. But
I mean, it really comes in Diamond Dogs. You can really hear it. I'll make you a deal like any other candidate. You know, he really, the change is quite obvious there. But
is that cigarettes or like, I mean, because I don't know anything about, you know, vocal style. But
I think it may be just it's probably, you know, just the constant use of the voice, getting older, you know. He may have trained in a way that he hadn't before.
Certainly not getting fatter, I'll tell you that much.
No, it wasn't getting fatter, that's true.
But okay, five years, Dee, sorry to keep
Yeah, 5 years.
Sorry, 5 years, yeah.
So, I think someone said Dr. Britton says voice coaching. I think there's probably a degree of that. I think he certainly did have training, because there's no way a young Bowie really could have pulled off some of those extraordinary later songs like Fantastic Voyage. I mean, that's, you really need a trained voice to be able to do that. Anyway, so 5 years, I mean, I think it's a absolutely killer first song on a record, because, you know, I mean, one thing I love about it is it starts with a heartbeat, basically that drum, you know, Woodmansey's drum figures, you know, it really hit boom, 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 you know, it gives that kind of character of leading a leading the record in with this kind of heartbeat. And it's very sparse, you know, at the beginning. But the song is, yes, basically the story of the world learning that there are only 5 years left. It's also interesting because it comes from different characters. So the first few verses of the song are from a child, you know. So you've got some I heard telephones, opera house, you know, that's all boys, toys, electric irons and TV, my brain hurt like a warehouse, all the fat, skinny people, tall, short people. I mean, it's clearly kind of the way a young person or a child would sort of like process the image of all of these people gnashing and wailing in the streets after having found out this terrible news. And then it shifts quite drastically to Bowie's direct voice, which may also be Ziggy Stardust. You don't really get the kind of deliberate introduction of the Ziggy Stardust character until a few songs into the record. But I think around the time where you get, let's see, where do we get? Yeah, you start getting these really sort of negative societal disintegration images. Girl my age went off her head, hit some tiny children. If the black hadn't pulled her off, I think she would have killed them. A soldier with a broken arm fixed his stare to the wheels of Cadillac. A cop knelt and kissed the feet of a priest, and a queer threw up at the sight of that. I think I saw you in an ice cream parlor, drinking milkshakes cold and long, smiling and waving and looking so fine. Don't think you knew you were in this song. And it was cold, and it rained, so I felt like an actor. And I thought of Ma, and I wanted to get back there. Your face, your race, the way that you talk. I kiss you. You're beautiful. I want you to walk. And then we've got 5 years. And then very quickly, his performance becomes maniacal and frantic. You know, he's basically, after a few stands, a few more, you know, repetitions of the chorus, he's basically screaming, 5 years!
Yeah, my brain hurts a lot.
My brain hurts a lot. Because all we've got, 5 years. What a surprise. We've got 5 years stuck on my eyes. And then the spiders come in and they sort of do this kind of pub chant of it in the end, you know. 5 years! 5 years! And they sort of like tame down this kind of maniacal shrieking that he's doing. So it's a very interesting, and then of course it fades back out into the sparse heartbeat like drum solo, which is it's just a wonderful, strange song. And again, it's multiple sort of perspectives that shift without warning. It's very unusual, I think.
Yeah, I've always, as great as this song is, I've always felt that both 5 years and Rock and Roll Suicide, the bookends of the album, feel to me, they've always felt to me like they kind of stand a little bit apart from the rest of the songs as well. Because when we go from this into Soul Love, it's like, oh, right, now this rock and roll record is starting. And we're hit with, what is it, like 10... rockers straight in a row, like bang 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 bang. Lady Stardust slows things down a little bit, but it's something that Dylan talks about, fast songs and slow songs. But it's like, well, I mean, 5 years, it's a slow song, right? And then it's like rocker, 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 and then we slow down again at the end with Rock and Roll Suicide, and that's a sparse or more acoustic track as well. So to me, like I don't know why, in my imagination, those two songs, even though they're great, they also kind of stand apart, almost like the covers of a book or something.
I suspect that the inclusion of them in that way was probably deliberate, because you're right. I mean, they really are. They're kind of the opening and the denouement of this narrative. And they are very different songs. You know, again, the sparseness of 5 years is sort of mirrored in the sparseness of Rock and Roll Suicide. They both, of course, begin in a kind of almost quiet, sparse way, and then they proceed towards kind of musical fervor, a kind of fervor in vocal performance, and a kind of almost breakdown, you know, of the music in a way. I mean, if you remember 5 years, I mean, there's a kind of orchestral arrangement that comes in, and then they're, you know, when he's screaming, they're kind of sawing at their instruments. You know, there's this very cacophonous kind of moment, and then it all sort of rejoins a kind of order. And the same thing happens in Rock and Roll Suicide to a bit, although it's slightly less discordant, but it does sort of progress from, you know, from quiet sparseness to lush, you know, loud
you know,
melody.
There's that famous
silence.
You know, there's that famous meme of the Wojak who's got the mask, and then underneath it he's crying,
yeah,
and he's kind of desperate underneath it. I mean, as we've been talking, it kind of strikes me that the character that we meet, I mean, in a couple of tracks, you know, the absolute swagger of Moon Age Daydream, you know, I'm an alligator, I'm a rock and roll, and you know, he's so kind of full of confidence and smooth on some of those middle tracks, but on the bookends, this is someone who's like falling apart at the seat, like is kind of a wreck underneath the mask, if that makes any sense. I find that quite interesting as well, as a kind of not just as a comment on this Ziggy Stardust character, but on the nature of performers in general, because you do see that quite a lot. Is that like, you know, I mean, funny enough, I mentioned Ric Flair earlier on. Everybody knows that in his private life, he's a total wreck.
Strange enough, I watched a little clip of a kind of speech he gave last night, and he just seemed like a lunatic.
Yeah, I mean, he really
seemed out of it.
But there are people who come alive in front of 70,000 people or 20,000 people, or they need the crowd, but you know, they you know, somehow that brings them into being alive, but when they're just alone or whatever, they, you know, they can't deal with the life or whatever.
I can certainly relate to that.
So shall we move on to Soul Love?
Yep. Soul Love. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you'd be hard pressed to fit this into a narrative because it has nothing. I mean, in the Nicholas Pegg book, he says only the most overworked imagination could slot this song directly into a Ziggy Stardust narrative.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the most interesting thing about it is it shows a kind of there's a kind of cynical, slightly nihilistic tone to it. I mean, it kind of presents itself as an almost kind of gentle, positive song, and it has that kind of sound to it. But if you actually sort of look at the lyric, I mean, he's not particularly. I don't know. I just feel there's a kind of underlying cynicism to the song. So let's just look at it. Stone Love, she kneels before the grave, a brave son who gave his life to save the slogan, hovers between the headstone and her eyes, but they penetrate her grieving. And I think that fits with Bowie's general disdain for attaching himself to a cause.
But Buckley, in his book, claims that this song is full of remonstrations about the link between secular and non-secular love. Mm. In fact, Buckley's reading of the album in general says that there's a lot more kind of religious and esoteric themes on each of these songs than people may realize.
It comes out in a weird way. I mean, even in 5 years, you know, there's that whole strange scene of the cop kneeling and kissing the feet of the priest, and the queer throwing up sight of that. I mean, there's a lot of explicit and implicit references to sort of religious.
And the apocalypse, of course, which is
and the apocalypse, and a messiah, a leper messiah. You know, yes, I mean, yeah, I think that's a big part of this record. I mean, there's a deeply sort of, you know, less of the kind of esoteric tone that he would adopt in later records, but
yeah, this is the Christian God, basically. This is like this is Christianity that is being it's kind of in the background of the record, or in the, I mean, even on this song, maybe even the foreground.
Well, I think it's true. Love is careless. Well, so new love, a boy and girl are talking new words that only they can share it. New words, a love so strong it tears their hearts to sleep through the fleeting hours of morning. But then he comes in and says, love is careless in its choosing, sweeping over cross a baby. Love descends on those defenseless. Idiot love will spark the fusion. All inspirations have I none, just to touch the flaming dove. All I have is my love of love, and love is not loving. I mean, to me, there's just a very sort of cynical tone relating to the nature of, you know, childbirth, which is, of course, one of the most sacred experiences of human existence. You know, but he's, you know, being very black-pilled there. You know, basically, idiot love will spark the fusion, and what you get is, you know, is a lottery, and it's probably going to come out all wrong for you. I don't know, maybe I'm alone in that assessment.
Well, we go from here to the Church of Man Love on the next song. such a holy place to be. Now, to me, Moon Age Daydream is one of the great Bowie songs. I've always thought...
Oh, have we moved on? Oh.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise we'll be here all day. But
All right.
Yeah, so Moon Age Daydream. I've always loved the way this song opens, you know.
Yes, this is absolutely one of the... I think it's in my list of Bowie's best songs of all time. I mean, the opening of this song is an absolute killer, because, of course, it comes, this D chord, this D chord that Mick Ronson does, and then goes to an F sharp. It comes during the fade out of Soul Love. So if you listen very carefully to the album, you'll hear that Soul Love has not quite completed its fade, and then all of a sudden you get bum, ba-dum. And it's such a wonderful thing. You know, just a punch in the face. It's a bit like reminds me always of that drum kick at the beginning of Like a Rolling Stone, you know. It's just this kind of slap in the face.
Just one of the great opening, you know, one of the great openings to a song. Which I tweeted it out earlier on, didn't I? I'm an alligator.
Yeah. and so we can do a little bit of a deep reading here. I'm an alligator, which of course is a merciless predator. I'm a mama papa coming for you. So it's again, he's sort of casting himself as the, I would say, the you know, this esoteric idea of the mother and father, of the male and female principles combined in a figure. I'm a space invader, you know, he's an alien. And also, I think implied in the idea of being a space invader is the invasion of sex, the invasion of the penis, you know, as being a kind of penetrator.
I always thought that there was a bit of channeling of Iggy Pop here. You know, that song, Search and Destroy, on Raw Power. Mm. But I've just realized that Raw Power was recorded after this. So it can't be.
After
because
this, okay.
Because there's, you know, there's another brilliant opener is how that album opens. I'm a street-walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of the nuclear A-bomb. I'm the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. It's got that same swagger, but it was written afterwards. And in fact, both of these books I've got, because they talk about the influence of Lou Reed and Iggy Pop on Bowie always.
Yeah.
But these books stress, actually, people underrate the influence the other way around. How much Bowie was an influence on Reed.
Oh, absolutely.
And how much Bowie was an influence on Iggy Pop then as well.
Yeah, it was absolutely mutual. Yeah. I think it was absolutely mutual, certainly later on. Strangely enough, there was a very explicit Iggy Pop reference in the original version of this song. So the line, "Keep your electric eye on me, babe," used to be "Keep your TV eye on me, babe," which is, of course, you know, a line straight from Iggy Pop. Change for this record. So,
you know, there's a lot of Buckley in his reading of the song. Basically says that there's a lot of comment on rock history by Bowie here, by his utilization of slangy hip Americanisms,
yep,
which he thinks are deliberate. So, for example,
absolutely,
Mama, yep, Papa, freak out, far out, lay it on,
electric, yeah, yeah. And that happens throughout the record. I mean, you know, I forgot to mention, he deliberately inserts lots of Americanisms. I mean, calling a policeman a cop, calling a what else? Oh, I think there's very, very deliberate use of American idioms.
But that actually occurred to me when I was listening to it on my drive yesterday, that freak out and far out, and these are kind of 60s slang.
Yep.
So in a way, he's already doing this weird thing where, even though he's doing it, he's distanced from it as well, because there's a kind of ironic distance between the subject matter and the artist. I'll just put it that way. So that kind of hadn't occurred to me.
Busting up
before.
My brains, Now I want to bring up one line here. Well, two lines. So I'll be a rock and rollin' bitch for you, which at the time, the inclusion of the word bitch in this way, I think was rather unusual. But we're somewhat more used to that term. But I think there's deliberately a sort of, let's say, a sexually passive. He's casting that character again in the next line. I mean, he goes from alligator to being your bitch, literally.
Yeah, and it goes back to what he was saying about being a whore.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, there is also another Iggy Pop reference here as well. I want to be your dog, of course, which is making it. That's from that, and that is from the original Stooges album. I seem to recall
that may be a direct lift. You know, now the other line that concerns me here is, "You're squawking like a pink monkey bird," and there is a book by, I think, a man named Peter Blodgett, who wrote at least one biography. He maybe wrote a specific book about this record, and he asserts that this is gay slang for a bottom. I have never found any other reference to pink monkey bird being a reference to a passive sexual partner in anal sex, but that is it. And if you look for it, you'll find all over the internet people citing, oh yeah, it's gay sex slang term. But they're all referring to this Peter Blodgett book, and I've never found any other, you know, I don't know. There's now apparently a group called Pink Monkey Birds. So you half of it you get people talking about Bowie, and half of it is people talking about this group I've never heard of. So who knows? I don't know, but I've never heard that.
A pink monkey bird. So there we go.
Pink monkey bird.
Yeah, I'm just having a look. To see what else about that. I mean, it's a great song, though. Really good song.
It is.
And it's kind of spacey as well. You know, there's the ray gun and the... It is lean. I mean, this is... To me, this is always like where Ziggy arrives on the album.
Yes, this is Ziggy's entrance. Yeah. This is the first time that his voice is sort of explicitly on the record. Oh, go on.
I was going to move on, so if you want anything else. So.
Oh!
Sorry.
Yeah. I can't keep up with this.
I'm what they call in pro wrestling, a go-go-go worker.
Oh, dear.
We should talk about Mick Ronson's solo as well before we move
Yeah, Mick
on.
Ronson's solo is absolutely incredible in this. And of course, Bowie, apparently during Hunky Dory, he was not particularly helpful to his band. in that he really didn't give them any kind of direction or guidance, or very little. Whereas during the sessions for Ziggy Stardust, he apparently changed his tack very much, and he had this sort of technique where he would draw diagrams of what he wanted the shape of Bronson's or the other musicians, what he wanted the sort of shape of their kind of contribution to the song. And so this, you know, he would sort of draw this kind of figural diagram, and then Mick Ronson might go off to the loo and sit down and write it out, and then come back, and almost every time he would perfectly, sort of according to Bowie, perfectly did what he wanted. I mean, he was absolutely brilliant, Ronson, and of course did the orchestrations on this record as well. So yes, that solo, and of course the solo mimics the vocal line. You know, it sort of follows the vocal line very closely at first, and it's very good.
I think Ronson also played the piano on this record as well. I think Rick Wakeman is gone. He was part of the band. Let me just double check.
Yeah, Wakeman appears in one song uncredited. He plays the harpsichord on It Ain't Easy. There's a harpsichord, if you can hear, and that's Rick Wakeman. But otherwise, I think it was either Bowie or Ronson playing the piano. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. That's, oh, we should mention, by the way, the famous Japanese designer of this.
Yeah.
What's his name again? Let me just look it up.
It's not Issey Miyake. He wouldn't have been that early, would he?
It's hold on a minute, because you know he was talking about bringing Japanese elements in. This is one of the most famous examples of the Japanese element. Remember the guy's name though. Kanzai. Japanese designer Kanzai Yamamoto. So that is the designer of this. So there we go. He apparently saw a Kanzai display at Harper's. Just walking past it, and he was like, yes, must have this for Ziggy, basically. So there we go.
Well, there's some very interesting interviews that Bowie gave at various points where he talks about the sort of fashion and style of Ziggy Stardust. And he deliberately he wanted it to be like as if these were sort of cobbled together from cheap crap that they had around, you know, like he didn't want them to necessarily look like these super high fashion, you know, sort of clothing.
I mean, this one is also from the same designer, I believe, Kanzai Yamamoto, again seen in Harper's. So and if you there's do a, it, yeah,
there's a very cursed picture of David Hogg, you know, that young yes, there's a very cursed picture of him wearing this, a knockoff of this. He apparently had a foray into fashion designing, and he copied this one-legged knit body stocking, and there's a terrible photograph of him wearing it. Don't look for it.
Apparently the hairstyle also comes from this Harper's Kanzai display, because Yamamoto was using a kabuki lion's wig on his models.
It does look like a kabuki lion wig. I've never thought of that. Yeah.
So he said the Ziggy hairstyle was taken lock, stock, and barrel from this Kanzai display. Basically, he just wanted his own version of it. And he said, I got it to stand up with lots of blow drying and this dreadful early hair lacquer. So there we go.
Hair lacquer.
So there we go. And I think it's just worth mentioning the fact that this is a kind of weird alien and androgynous character who wears Japanese wigs. Such a bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bizarre thing. So there we go. anyway, Now on to Starman, which was the lead single, I believe, from Ziggy, yes. Was it not?
Yeah. In fact, Starman was written because I think RCA complained that when they heard some of the tracks, they said there's no single on this record. And so Starman, I think, was deliberately put together as a single.
And it's worth bearing in mind where we are in terms of Bowie's actual stardom at this point. To most people at home in the summer of 1972, to the average Top of the Pops viewer, David Bowie was still just a one-hit wonder who'd had a novelty single about an astronaut at the end of the previous decade. So they literally only knew him from Space Oddity.
Yeah.
So it's kind of difficult to wrap in your mind that Man Who Sold the World and Hunky Dory, even though they're great records, they didn't really make a splash.
Nope, so, not at all. Not at all.
And do you remember when we were seeing the repackaging of those songs as Ziggy songs later? That was them basically needing material to capitalize on like the Bowie mania that was coming in this moment. And it was really Starman that and his performance on Top of the Pops.
Top of the Pops.
Of Starman that basically launched the Bowie that we know now.
If people have never watched that, you should, after this, you should go and look that up, because it's an incredible performance. It's also one of the slightly rare Top of the Pops appearances of this era where he's actually performing live. You know, many of them were mimed, even Roxy Music mimed.
I had it on the Best of Bowie DVD, which is a great DVD from back in the day, but you'll probably just find it on YouTube now, wouldn't you?
It used to be there.
Yeah, I mean, Starman, like, it's weird because it was the lead single, but I always think the Starman gets kind of lost in the shuffle on this album. Like, I never think of it as one of the great songs on here, but it's catchy, you know, it's a good single.
I love this song. I think it's a wonderful song. I mean, you know, again, this is probably one of the very explicit songs that you could say was narrative and addressing the theme of the record, you know, because it's talking about these two teenagers who tune in to Ziggy sending a message to the young people.
Some of the stuff these critics write is something else.
Rock criticism is the worst.
The chorus is at once messianic and arrogant. Let all the children... right, just listen to this line. Let all the children boogie, conflates Christ suffer little children to come unto me. With Mary Antoinette, let them eat cake.
All right.
I mean, okay, I suppose. Yeah.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. There's a star man waking in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us. Thinks he'd blow our minds. Yeah. And this song is, again, full of Americanism, you know. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, lot of soul, he said. Hazy cosmic jive. One thing I think people may not realize about this song is there's a very, very explicit reference to one of the inspirations of Bowie at the time, which was Somewhere Over the Rainbow, the Judy Garland song from Wizard of Oz. And if you think about this song, the chorus of it is very literally an octave jump, just like Over the Rainbow. So Starman is very like Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And that's a very clear and deliberate inclusion there. So, and the whole song is sort of, again, this idea of being transported, you know, out of the world.
During an interview for Rolling Stone in November 1973, Bowie launched into a disquisition on the song's place in his planned Ziggy Stardust stage production. The end comes when the infinites arrive. They really are a black hole, but I've made them people because it would be very hard to explain a black hole on stage.
Yeah.
Ziggy is advised in a dream by the infinites to write the coming of a Starman. So he writes Starman, which is the first news of hope that the people have heard. So they latch onto it immediately. The Starmen that he is talking about are called the Infinities, and they are black hole jumpers.
Ziggy black has hole been talking... which is from the Three Doctors episode of Doctor Who.
Yes, and then it says that the storyline has taken wholesale from the Three Doctors. So, it's a good job.
Did you get the part about him including a big black woman called Queenie?
that is not mentioned here.
I am so happy that they never produced that.
So there we go. The black hole jumpers never made it onto stage.
Thank God. Starman. Yeah. I'm also thinking now. And speaking of the kind of Somewhere Over the Rainbow octave jump, is also in Life on Mars, except it's in the opposite direction. He, that shifting up. It's a great sort of musical theater tactic, you know. It always has drama, and I think he used it quite deliberately a number of times.
It's always fun when that happens. I like it as well. I'm a sucker for it. According to this, the sources also include T-Rex's Hot Love, Telegram Sam, the Supremes, You Keep Me Hanging On, via Blue Mink's Melting Pot, whatever the fuck that means. I don't know. It's just rock writing, isn't it? Oh, yeah. You know, the chorus is lifted from the Supremes, You Keep Me Hanging On, via Blue Mink's Melting Pot, while the chorus melody itself is swiped from Judy Garland's Suit Over the Rainbow.
So well, that one's true, but, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, yeah, both. Of course it's influenced by that song. They both have an A flat in them, so it must be the same.
Yeah, and this bit is true as well, that that Suede basically made a career out of stealing bits from this song, like in Beautiful Ones, you know, that octave shift that we were talking about. They do that ad nauseum in Suede are the masters of that octave shift, actually. Every single song.
Terrible.
Although they wrote one bass song, in my opinion. There's a great big crack in the Union Jack. That's a Suede song, it's simple call. Anyway, we move from Starman to, in my view, a song that is unfairly maligned on this album. It Ain't Easy.
It ain't easy. Yeah.
Because I think it helps. It's a straightforward rocker, and it helps with the momentum of the song, of the album, in my opinion. But because it is a cover of a Ron Davis song, it tends to get given short shrift. For example, David Buckley, in his account, simply says this pleasant enough cover of a little known Ron Davis song just doesn't fit in, and its inclusion on the album is doubly puzzling given the stockpile of excellence Bowie had at the time. What's he on about? It fits like a glove. It's a great song. So there we go. The Peg basically says it's wrongly attributed to Ray Davis sometimes because he has a really similar name.
I don't think Ray Davis would have written something like this.
That's it, basically. Yeah, he has nothing else to say, really, of note. So I just like it. I think it's got a good chorus. Good rocker.
And thematically, it certainly fits because it begins, you know, when you climb to the top of the mountain, look over the sea, think about the places perhaps where a young man could be. I mean, it's very much the kind of view from space at the beginning. And then it gets into, again, sort of this Christian iconography. People, all the people have got their problems. That ain't nothing new. With the help of the good Lord, we can all pull on through. We can all pull on through, get there in the end, you know. So it's sort of on theme, you know, and it works well. I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't have the love of a hoochie-coochie woman, though, so I don't know about
the,
that.
The thing about critics is that I've noticed they have a really sharp bias against cover versions of songs. And it leads them to dismiss some genuinely good records sometimes. Like, I'm a big fan of the very first Bob Dylan album. I think it's got like a great kind of punkish energy about it. But because he didn't write them, they just dismiss it.
yeah.
you know, or they don't spend long on it. Oh, let's get on to Blowing in the Wind quickly, you know. Yeah. I find that they're a bit like this about Bowie's cover version sometimes as well. Anyway, we go from It Ain't Easy to Lady Stardust, which is famously about Mark Bolan. I've always liked this song. Good deal.
Yep. Good song.
What do you think?
Yeah, it was a good song. I mean, again, it's you know, there's a bit of the kind of foreshadowing of the blurred pronouns in this song, because it's never quite clear whether Lady Stardust is a lady or not. But you know, it's again infused with this kind of almost theatrical nostalgia. And again, it has the Spiders from Mars coming in and doing their slightly kind of, you know, slightly off kilter pub, you know, soccer sing along thing. All right, you know, they kind of chime in with that.
And then we go from Lady Stardust, because to me this middle section is just like, oh, we're up and running, it's awesome, you know.
Yeah,
and that's what It Ain't Easy does. It just keeps the momentum up. You need that sometimes. But then there's a song which I think is criminally underrated, or not raved about enough, which is Star. It's always been one of my favorite tracks on this album.
It's a great song.
It's just brilliant. I love Star. I mean, you know, you can come home like a regular superstar.
I could fall asleep that night as a rock and roll. Yeah. Well, of course, at the beginning, Tony went to fight in Belfast. Rudy stayed at home to starve. I could make it all worthwhile as a rock and roll star. Bevan tried to change the nation. Sonny wants to turn the world. Well, he can tell you that he tried. I can make a transformation as a rock and roll star. I mean, it's again this kind of back and forth of, you know, of kind of young men, you know, falling and having their dreams defeated, you know, and fighting for a cause and losing, and then interspersed with Ziggy's kind of ambition, you know, sort of that's becoming a bit maniacal, I would say, at this point.
Yeah, I love a song with a kind of pounding, hammering piano as well. I love an upbeat rock piano track, so Star's got that going for it as well. And then literally it doesn't let up. This is why I'm saying this is how great this album is, because you just go straight from that to Hang On To Yourself, which is another rock, like massive rocker. I like that one as well. It's just like kind of, you know, I mean, they're all on a theme, aren't they? They're all, you know, this is where the concept part comes in.
Yeah, this is the concept part. Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, even it gets a name check, the Spiders from Mars. We can't dance, we don't talk much, we just ball and play. But then we move like tigers on Vaseline.
What's a tiger on Vaseline?
It's a tiger sliding on a layer of Vaseline. What do you think?
I mean, whenever there's any talk of Vaseline, I just get nightmarish flashbacks to playing rugby when I was like 12 and stuff. Because the rugby locker room was just a very Vaseline heavy. There was just Vaseline everywhere. But I don't know why they were so big on Vaseline, but taking showers with each other and so on. So yes. Well, I told you before, I used to walk home muddy and have a shower at home.
Of course you wouldn't have a shower with lads.
I fucking want to have a shower with you know. Let's rub each other in Vaseline and compare cocks and piss on each other.
Base. All right.
What else is going on?
What else? Come on, we've got a good thing going. Hang On To Yourself. I mean, it's funny because all these kind of middle section songs, they have a couple of sort of lyrical statements at the beginning, and then most of the song is the kind of repetition of the chorus or a refrain. This one as well. I mean, you know, half the song is "Come on, come on, come on, lay it on. We got a good thing going. Hang on." You know, it's sort of repetition, and then of course at the end, the kind of rhythmic panting. Come on, come on. You know, there's clearly a very sex and death heavy thing going on in this record.
And then we hit the title track,
yeah,
which is another really good song. Slightly slower, actually, after the kind of euphoria of the last few songs. I mean, I don't know if Ziggy Stardust counts as a slow song, but it's definitely slightly slower than the rockers that have preceded it. What have you got to say about this one?
Well, let's just quickly zip through the lyrics. Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Weird and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Came the Special Man. Then they were Ziggy's band. Ziggy really sang, screwed up eyes and screwed down hairdo like some cat from Japan. He could lick him by smiling. He could leave him to hang. He came on so loaded, man. Well hung, snow white tan. Yeah. And of course, this was, again, the kind of image of the perfect plastic rock star. You know, a pallid, you know, sort of drunken, drugged out person who looked like they were on the edge of consciousness, who had a big cock and, you know, and played guitar. I mean, that was, you know, that was the sort of be-all and end-all. I mean, aside from all this talk about Ziggy as some sort of, you know, messianic figure, you know, he's basically nothing but a sort of, you know, a fashionable ornament.
Listen to this twat peg again, sorry.
Oh, no.
The title track, I mean, I will say this Nicholas Pegg book is quite good, but some of his takes are funny. He says the title track of Ziggy Stardust album is also its central piece of narrative. Bowie's richly elusive lyric riding over one of his finest guitar rock melodies as he charts the rise and fall of the sci-fi superstar himself. Tantalizing clues, you wanker. Tantalizing clues as to Ziggy's identity.
What?
Blur the Mark Bolan resonances conjured up earlier on the album. There are obvious suggestions of Jimi Hendrix in the guitar hero who played it left hand while driving us that we were voodoo.
Voodoo.
That's true, because he does have was a voodoo, and then and was
voodoo
killed
child.
By the kids, right? He and was killed by the kids, but the cryptic observation that he was the Naz suggests a host of other possibilities. The Naz was a name shared by erstwhile backing bands of both Todd Rundgren and Alice Cooper. Who had also fronted a group called the Spiders in the mid-1960s. While some have suggested that the word implies both Nazarene, hence Christ, and Nazi, dovetailing nicely with the album's totalitarian undertones and Bowie's later evaluation of Hitler as one of the first rock stars.
Amazing. Who wrote this?
So there we go. Nicholas Pegg.
Oh, it's Pegg, okay.
Yeah, so that's... So there we go. I was just kind of wildly careers off, and it's like, yeah, maybe he's talking about Hitler. So
yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, that the Naz. I mean, I always took it for, you know, Jesu Nazarenum, very very specifically, and the Rungren thing. But to be Nazi with a God-given ass, I don't think Hitler had a God-given ass. I mean, technically he did, but you know, he took it all up too far. He made his love with his ego sucked up into his mind, which is also a callback to Queen Bitch, where there's a line about sucking into your brain, or
So then we go from the title track to a song called Suffragette City, which is another high tempo rocker. Now, yep. D, I have my own controversial take on what this song means, but I will let you say what you think about this one first. It was actually it was released as a single, believe it or not. It was lost. It was coupled with Stay, released in 1976 to promote Changes One Bowie, and was a complete flop, not even denting the lower reaches of the top 75. So
yeah, it's got the and it has the That single has the station to station, you know, type style and an image. Yeah.
So I didn't know it was released with Stay later on.
Yeah, it was a single in the station era. Also, you will be pleased to know that this is one of only two popular songs in the entire catalog of pop songs that has the word suffragette. Do you know what the other one is?
No. What is it?
It's that song from Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's the only other pop song with the word suffragette in the title.
Well, apparently Mott the Hoople rejected this song, and they took all the young dudes instead.
All the young dudes. Yeah, and there's an apocryphal story that Bowie was so upset that he shaved off his eyebrows. I don't know if that's true or not, but
now here's my galaxy brain take on what this song is about. Right.
All right.
This is a song about how Ziggy or David or whoever you want is not up for the old gay sex tonight, and instead is having sex with a woman. And once you see, I mean, once I've made this reading, I can't unmake it. Basically, let me just make my case. Hold on, let me just get out the Suffragette City lyrics.
No. Right. All right. Now, I'm settling in.
Hey, man. Oh, leave me alone. Hey, man. Oh, Henry, get off the phone. Hey, man, I got to straighten my face. Straighten, like de-gayify, right? This mellow thigh chick just put my spine out of place. Okay. Hey, man. My school day's insane, blah, blah, blah. Hey, man. She's a total blam blam. She said she had to squeeze it, but then she, okay, and like, here's the key bit. Oh, don't lean on me, man, because you can't afford the ticket. I'm back on Suffragette City having sex with women again. Don't lean on me, man, i.e. don't try to bum me, because you ain't got time to check it. You know, my Suffragette City is out of sight and she's all right. And then it carries on. Hey, man, Droogie, don't crash here. There's only room for one, and here she comes, and here she comes. Yeah,
by the way, there's a very specific reference to Clockwork Orange. Yeah, Droogie.
The Droogie, yes. So what do you make of that reading?
I think that is one of your worst takes, and that is saying something.
Why?
Yeah. I know.
What's the song about then, if he's not...
Honestly, out of all the songs, I have no idea what this song is about, you know. Hey, man, oh, leave me alone, you know. Hey, I mean, I love this song for some reason, even though it's mostly him repeating the word Suffragette City again and again. But I don't know, but it's not that, I could say that.
Here's what Peg says.
Yeah, what's Peg say? Yeah.
Depending on how much gender bending one wishes to read into the lyric. You see, I had a very heteronormative reading of the song.
Yeah, heteronormativity.
Here's what he says. Depending on how much gender bending one wishes to read into the lyric, it's either a laddish request to be left alone with a girlfriend. Hey, look, the AA reading, front and center. or else, in the same vein as John, I'm Only Dancing, it's an AC/DC switch from boyfriend to girlfriend. What the fuck does that mean? What's an AC/DC switch?
AC/DC is an old slang term for bisexual.
I see. Notably, Bowie addresses his male friend as Droogie, a direct reference to A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. So basically, he's got the same meaning as me. Oh, it's gaining momentum. Let's see what Buckley says. Hold on a minute.
But he talks about women in other songs. I mean, this isn't, you know, what about the Coochie Mama, Coochie Woman.
This is a song in which he's specifically saying, look, listen, tonight I'm with her. You know, and we're gonna rock it old school. So step out, Droogie.
See, I could buy this reading of John, I'm Only Dancing, but not of this one.
I mean, I am suggesting that the Suffragette City is old-fashioned bobs and vagine sex. That's what I'm suggesting. And then we get Rock and Roll Suicide.
So. Wait. All right. Yeah, Rock and Roll Suicide.
So, I mean, he goes back to to the mellow fat chick, and
now the mellow fried chick.
The mellow fried chick, indeed. And now we're playing out. So
yeah, and this song has always been really sort of meaningful to me, the one reason and the other. But of course, this is after the death of Ziggy Stardust. Whether you want to sort of interpret that death literally or figuratively, I think that there's a case to be made for that it's the death of this sort of persona. You know, the death of this kind of delusional ideation of himself as a space alien messiah. Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth, you pull on your finger, then another finger, then your cigarette. Which also reminds me of his, you know, he was a big fan of Jacques Brel. And this song is always sounded a bit to me like it could be a Jacques Brel song. He performed, famously did covers of a few Jacques Brel. He did, during the Ziggy Stardust tour, they did My Death, which is Bowie's own translation of Mamour by Brel.
Now, what was his fandom of Brel through Scott Walker, which is how most of us get familiar with him?
It may have been. I'm not entirely sure how he. It may have picked up the Brel thing when he was going to meme school. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah. So you're too old to lose it. You're too young to choose it. And the clock waits so patiently on your song. You walk past a cafe, but you don't eat when you live too long. Your rock and roll suicide. Chev breaks a Stalin as you stumble across the road, but the day breaks instead, so you hurry home. I mean, again, we've got three stanzas of, three verses of kind of disintegration, you know, and disarray and decline from this character. Reminds me of this bit that this impending action followed by basically a false denouement and just a kind of resolution. And then it's sort of, as with 5 years, it goes from this sort of calm, imagistic description through these various lines. And then it starts to he starts to kind of switch into mania again. So, you know, he says, don't let the sun blast your shadow. Don't let the milk float ride your mind. You're so natural, religiously unkind. And then, oh, no, love, you're not alone. Yeah. And you know, you get this huge burst. And again, his voice takes on that kind of ragged, screeching quality. You're watching yourself, but you're too unfair. He goes up an octave into the high registers there, and then, you know, his performance kind of ends in sort of a total disintegration. Give me your hands, and which is mellowed out again by the backing vocals, which are, you know, singing in a kind of respectful melodic way, and of course the wonderful orchestration by Mick Ronson, which fills out the end of this song. And I think this also has a very specific kind of reference to A Day in the Life by the Beatles, because it ends with that chord, you know, it ends with the, you know, how the Day in the Life has the, mm-hmm. has the kind of, bong, you know, this sort of resolution at the end, and this song does as well. And then it's, you know, and then it's all quiet, it's all done.
I mean, to me, this is one of Bowie's best songs, period, on any album. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It is. It's very good. It's quite profound as well. And one of the cool things that he did, because famously, every single Ziggy Stardust show on the tour closed with this song. So there's a kind of, I don't know, like a... Because he was very interested in making art life and life art all through his career, even with his death, right? He even made a statement with his death, right?
A very complicated one as well.
When he actually retired as Ziggy Stardust, and they said it was the last show, and It was a Hammersmith, right? And there's a famous film of that show. And there's,
yeah, by D.A. Pennybaker, who famously made Don't Look Back, the Dylan film, and many, many other things. He was a very prolific documentarian. But yes, that film, which is the album to that, is also really, it's a really good live record. It wasn't released until a number of years after the original Ziggy Stardust. But yeah, if you've not heard that, definitely seek that out. But yeah, famously, he makes that statement. Not only is this the last show of the tour, but it's the last show that we're ever going to do. Thank you. And then the audience screamed.
When exactly was that performance? Was it after Aladdin Insane as well, or
I can just, let me look.
Because we're about to talk about Aladdin Insane. I've never been clear as to where Aladdin Insane starts and Ziggy Stardust ends, to be honest, because they just seem like the same character to me.
It's a very similar character, but it's 1973, so it was it would have been. Yeah, it was filmed on the 3rd of July, 1973. So, and Aladdin Sane, he began to work on Aladdin Sane, you know, really right after that. So,
yeah, and that came out in April. So, you know, it'd been out a couple of months.
Yeah, so he'd been working. And this film didn't come out until 1979, which I didn't know. The film of that concert, but
and that's definitely worth a watch as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, really. Great. I remember. Yeah, very good.
Yeah,
film.
And they perform. A lot of these songs dropped off. I mean, he didn't perform them quite very much ever again. So, Width of a Circle, you know, Cracked Actor, Wild Eyed Boy from Free Card. You're not going to really hear these again. They sort of fell out of the live rotation.
So there is a bit of a image shift with Aladdin Sane, though, because he gets the famous "This is Aladdin Sane" now, the kind of lightning, right?
Yes, the lightning bolt. I've always heard Aladdin Sane described as the American Ziggy Stardust.
Ziggy goes to America. Yeah,
Ziggy goes to America. Yeah, and so I think there's some truth to that, because the sound of the record and the kind of theme of a lot of the songs is very much a sort of rooted in a Panic in Detroit, and you know, going to the
I was actually really thinking I listened to Aladdin Sane as well on the drive. I'm looking for the front cover of Aladdin Sane. Where is it?
It's in there. It's definitely in there.
It struck me that like Panic in Detroit, like, is he talking about the race riots that happened there, or like, because it really is an interesting, that's an interesting song. I mean, we'll talk about the whole album in a second, but it made me think about like what it is about Bowie that's so interesting, and it's the fact that his reaction to that. Most people, I would say 99% of people's reaction to what was happening in Detroit would be political, i.e. on one side or the other side, right?
Right.
His response to it is aesthetic, right? He's kind of electrified by the energy of it and aesthetically appreciates what's going on, which is kind of the eye of the artist as opposed to the eye of... It's a kind of very weird, almost... very few people would have that response to what's going on. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, it's not the accepted political response to something like that. Certainly not today.
Yeah, I mean, it looks a lot like Che Guevara. He's appreciating the style of what's happening. You know. he's literally watching people jumping up and down on like cop cars and fucking buildings burning and things, and he's just like, yeah, this is cool, something's happening here, you know. Aladdin Sane, we get a big shift in the sound, because this Mike Garson comes on
board
as the pianist, and he would be a mainstay basically until the end of Bowie. Like, I think he's on a lot of the later albums as well, isn't he? And you can kind of, he's got a very different style to Rick Wakeman, as we talked about, because he's much jazzier and much kind of free form, I guess, and a bit discordant. But he really lets Garson go on some of these songs. I mean, I was listening on the title track and on...
Oh, yeah.
Like, he just lets him go. And it's kind of... It's interesting because I feel like Aladdin Sane is a bit more like, I mean, I've never really done drugs or anything like that, but there's a sugar rush on Ziggy Stardust, the album I'm talking about. It's high tempo, it's high energy, whereas Aladdin Sane feels a lot more like a hangover or a come down or a, it's a very different kind of feeling. You know, and I wonder how much of that is a kind of drug thing.
It could be. I mean, you know, this was certainly the beginning of Bowie's very deep foray into drugs, and certainly using heroin and cocaine, at least intermittently by this time. By the way, I sent you the actual Aladdin Sane cover on Twitter if you want to show that. I don't know. I also think, again, it's also a very specifically American sound. It's a very New York sound, as Lundberg points out.
The saxophone as well. The saxophone is all over this album, which would also be another Bowie mainstay because he played the sax himself.
Yes, he played the sax himself.
Peg says, Aladdin Sane's lyrics are riddled with images of urban decay, degenerate lives, drug addiction, violence, and death. Although in among the smack-crazed gangsters and rattled roos, there's a touching nostalgia for 1950s rock and roll and the golden age of Hollywood, as evidenced by both the title track and the Gene Genie, and Driving Saturday, which we'll talk about in a second.
Yes.
There's a firm restatement of the pantomimic element in Bowie's frame of reference. Aladdin, the epitome of the British pantomime, offers an appropriate model for an album recorded in London over the Christmas period, and the ever more extravagant costumes and makeup adopted by Bowie during 1973 pointed in the same direction. And there's just a bit of a line from Bowie himself here. He says, "The character of Aladdin Sane was, as Bowie explained, Ziggy goes to America. And the album supplants its predecessor's aspirational fantasy of America with the harsh reality that David would begin to experience. Here was this alternative world that I'd been talking about," he recalled many years later. "It had all the violence and all the strangeness and bizarreness, and it was really happening. It was real life, and it wasn't just in my songs. Suddenly, my songs didn't seem so out of place. All the situations that were going through were duly noted down, and all the remarks I had heard, real Americanisms that caught my ear. Just the look of certain places like Detroit really caught my imagination because it was such a rough city, and it almost looked like the kind of place I was writing about. I thought, I wonder if Kubrick has seen this town. It kind of makes the world in Clockwork Orange look kind of pansy." That's what he said, so...
Wow.
Interesting. That was in 1973.
73, which is, of course, I mean, Detroit, it gives you an idea of how quickly Detroit fell apart, because, of course, you can find, I think we watched, remember back on those old, you know, when we were watching information films and such, there was one about sort of Detroit, you know, this sort of, from the heyday, it was from the mid-1960s, and by the 70s, it was a complete wreck within 10 years. 15 years. So, I think a lot of people, very much like times we're living in, people don't realize how bad things can get so quickly that you would never conceive that civilization can fall apart that fast, but it can, and it does, and it has, and it will. But I always think of it,
would you agree that this is, because I've always thought that this is a darker album than Ziggy, but
Yes, much darker.
Carry on, D, sorry.
And I've always thought of this record as being, you know, you get the kind of presage of an apocalypse in Ziggy Stardust. Well, we've got 5 years. Aladdin Sane always seemed to me like this is what happened after. This is 6 years later, you know. Even though that, yeah, Detroit. There's some actually very specific references to that as we'll come on to. But and also, you know, this as you said, this record is filled with characters. You know, filled with very. I mean, for instance, the first song, "Watch That Man," shaky through a party. It lasted all night. Everybody drank a lot of something nice. There was an old-fashioned band of married men looking up to me for encouragement. It was so-so. The ladies looked bad, but the music was sad. No one took their eyes off Lorraine. She shimmied and she strolled like a Chicago mole. Her feathers and looked better and better. It was so-so. Yeah, it was time to unfreeze when the Reverend Alabaster danced on his knees. Slam! So it wasn't a game. Cracking all the mirrors in shame. I mean, you know, you get these vignettes, you know, almost like these sort of Otto Dix, you know, Weimar kind of vignettes of debauchery and louche lifestyle. So, yeah.
Yeah, and then, well, so it starts with Watch That Man. It goes into Aladdin Sane. Which I think, I mean, that's where Garson really, really kind of come as his coming out party, because he's all over that song, isn't he?
Yes, and it's just sort of that weird, very long bit at the end, a very discordant kind of solo. It's wonderful. It works very well in that song.
Buckley claims it's the album's arguably the outstanding track on the album.
I would beg to differ, but it's a very solid track. I mean, this is another record where I don't think there are any duds.
And then we go straight from that to Drive-In Saturday, which you messaged me about saying that you have things to say about this song.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think this is, again, another one of the best songs that Bowie ever wrote. I think this is an absolutely perfect song in musically, lyrically, theme, you know, thematically. But this song is very curious because, of course, it very much makes me think of the contemporary moment. In that the story in this song is that it's set in a world where there has been an apocalypse. It's a post-apocalyptic landscape where there are sort of only young people survived for one reason or the other, and they have forgotten, or they never learned how to have sex. And so they basically, you know, they're sort of dwindling because they don't know how to reproduce. And so they find some old porn films from before the apocalypse, and they use these to learn how to do it so that they can carry on the human race. To me, again, it's very prescient of a certain themes in the world today with young people.
Mick Jagger's eyes are going to save Western Civ.
Yeah, Jagger's eyes. People stared in Jagger's eyes. So let's go these lyrics. Let me put my arms around your head. Gee, it's hot. Let's go to bed. Don't forget to turn on the light. Don't laugh, babe. It'll be all right. Pull me out another phone. I'll ring and see if your friends are home. Perhaps the strange ones in the dome can lend us a book we can read up alone. And try to get it on one like once before, when people stared in Jagger's eyes and scored like the video films we saw. His name, and then he describes the porno. This is a description of the porno film, literally. His name was always Buddy. And he'd shrug and ask to stay. She'd sigh like Twig the Wonder Kid, which is literally a reference to Twiggy, who's on the cover of Pinups.
Yeah.
And turn her face away. She's uncertain if she likes him, but she knows she really loves him. It's a crash course for the ravers. It's a Drive-In Saturday. And then we get this quite esoteric list. Young the Foreman prayed at work. And I can't think that would be a reference to anyone else but Carl Jung. But people could beg to differ, that neither hands nor limbs would burst. It's hard enough to keep formation amid this fallout saturation. Cursing at the astronaut, who stands in steel by his cabinet, he's crashing out to a Sylvian, the Bureau supply for aging men. With snorting head, he gazes to the shore, where once had raged the sea that raged no more. Like the video film we saw, and then he repeats for the rest of the song.
I love his performance on this song, by the way. Just the way his name was always Buddy.
Buddy!
It was a big hit, you know. It was a number three hit. And Peg, unlike Buckley, he disagrees with Buckley as well. He thinks this is the he says this is the finest track on.
Yeah, this is the finest track. I agree.
So interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, I'm
seeing if I can find out. Very catchy tune. Very, very catchy tune.
Seeing if I can find out who this. Twig the Wonder Kid.
It's Twiggy. It's clearly Twiggy.
Yeah, the Arsonet is
the Astronet. Yeah.
Yeah, the Astronet is the name that Bowie had originally given to Lindsay Kemp's dancers during his Rainbow Theatre show. So
yeah, the Astronets.
The Astronets, yeah, sorry. Yes. There is no reference to Young by Peg, so.
Yeah, so, he's got to be talking about Carl Jung, because again, he would have been reading Man and His Symbols and all the other things, and because again, this sort of the Jungian archetype fit in with very well with this. Yeah.
I also think this is one of the Spiders' best backing performances as well. They're great on this song, you know. Because it's kind of like a sarcastic doo-wop 50s thing that they're doing.
Yeah, it's fake doo-wop. You know, again, this is something that I think. This is the problem that I think a lot of people have with Bowie, is they can't sort of understand that something can be synthetic and, you know, great at the same time. You know, I think people are sort of put off by this general sense with Bowie's work, most of his work, that there's a sort of insincerity at its core, which is absolutely true. I mean, as we talk about, you know, it's pose and spectacle and pastiche and all the other postmodern buzzwords, but it's also at the same time transcends that. It's not a kind of cynical, nihilistic sort of pastiche. You know, I think it literally uses pieces, bits and pieces of things to form something that's genuinely great. And I think a lot of people are put off by this. You know, this synthetic character, but I think Bowie was able to do it very well.
We go from that to Panic in Detroit, which we've mentioned a few times already. Peg has actually answered one of the questions I had, which is, who is this Che Guevara character at the start? Because, you know, it starts, he looked a lot like Che Guevara, drove a diesel van, kept his gun in quiet seclusion, such a humble man, the only survivor of the National People's Gang, Panic in Detroit. I asked for an autograph. There is actually a story on who this person is, because I was wondering, it doesn't sound like a black guy, but it also doesn't sound like anybody who would have been, you know, on the other side of that conflict. And it says, David was telling colorful tales of Detroit revolutionaries he had known during his youth in Michigan, right? So this is Iggy Pop was telling Bowie about Detroit revolutionaries that he had known. Thus emerged the gun-totting Che Guevara lookalike at the center of the lawless urban meltdown of Panic in Detroit. David later cited another source claiming that after the same gig in Los Angeles, he was astounded to meet a former classmate from Bromley Tech who had come to pay his respects. It was somebody who I used to go to school with, who ended up as a very big drug dealer in South America, and he flew in to see one of the shows and reintroduced himself. Wow. I don't believe it, I said. Is this what you are now? He was the full bit with the clothes and the piece and everything. I thought, my God, him? So it was somebody he knew from
Bromley Dennett.
Yes.
Amazing.
Who was dressed up basically as a kind of South American drug gangster. So there we go.
So it was a real person. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was probably the surrealness of the scene, like this kind of urban decay all around, meeting this guy from school who was basically, you know, I don't say LARPing, like living this kind of thing that you probably would have never dreamed of back in London. That's Panic in Detroit, unless you have anything else to say about it.
Yeah, I'm just wanting to get again. He's just very, very, very spare and wonderful lyric writing. I ran to the window, looked for a plane or two. Panic in Detroit. He left me an autograph. Let me collect dust. I wish someone would phone Panic in Detroit. Panic in Detroit. Yeah, I mean, just this. It goes from. I think this record, makes transitions from these absolutely sort of baroque explorations of sort of character vignettes to this, which. I think the sparseness fits the tone of the song.
Yeah, I mean, reading through the individual tracks, this is actually a very strong album because it goes Panic in Detroit to Crack Actor now.
Cracked Actor, which is a great song. And again, this is another kind of decayed character. I mean, this is very much like Ziggy in a way. This is a kind of decayed character who had experienced, you know, sort of top and fell to the bottom, you know, and especially of course because the character in this song is sort of riddled with, you know, sort of degenerate evil in a way.
It seems this is going to be like a very, very strange analogy I'm going to draw here, but there's something Henry the Fourth Part Two about what the, you know, this is like. There's something we have seen the chimes of.
We've seen the chimes of midnight. strangely enough, just a quick aside. There's a film that I very much like. It's a very flawed film, but it's from the early 90s, and it's called My Own Private Idaho. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's got Keanu Reeves and what's his name, the lad who overdosed and died. Why is it blown out of my head? Anyway, but that film is weirdly. I always think of that with when I listen to this record because it's also it's literally sort of modeled after Henry IV, Part Two, River Phoenix. Yeah, that's it. I see what you're getting at. I see what you're getting at.
Well, I mean, I'll just put it a different way. On Ziggy Stardust, he seems excited and exhilarated by the prospect of all of this. Whereas on this album, there's a bit of like buyer's regret creeping in, I reckon. It's just like, yeah, this is fucking depraved. What am I doing here? You know?
Yeah.
There's just a little bit of that, you know.
Come on a few years from my Hollywood highs, the best of the last, the cleanest star they ever had. I'm stiff on my legend. The films that I made, forget that I'm 50 because you just got paid. crack, baby, crack. Show me you're real. Smack, baby, smack is all that you feel. Suck, baby, suck. Give me your head before you start professing that you're knocking me dead.
do you reckon Harvey Weinstein ever played this song while he was...
Yeah,
fucking seedy, isn't it?
I mean, I always pictured this character as being an old puff. Yes. Nice. You caught yourself a trick down on Sunset and Vine. I mean, that's clearly a picking of a rent boy, you know. Yeah. But since he pinned you, baby, you're a porcupine. You sold me illusions for a sack full of checks. You made a bad connection because I just want your sex. Yeah, really, really nasty. Yeah. Song.
And there is that American transactional quality about it all as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But strangely enough, you get this weird little turn a couple of times in the song where suck, baby, suck, give me your head before you start professing, you're knocking me dead. But then stay, please stay, please stay. And you get that again. Ooh, yeah. Oh, stay for the day. Ooh, please stay. You know, there's this weird little, like, whimper of... of kind of pathetic loneliness amidst this song. It's so strange.
Very true. And then it goes straight on from that. I mean, to talk about the strength of the album, it goes straight from Cracked Actor to Time, which David Buckley points out is not only one of the few pop songs to include the word wanking and get away with it, this is another highly inventive track.
Yeah. Great. Another great song. If you'll permit me, I'll quote a couple of lyrics. Time, he's waiting in the wings. He speaks of senseless things. His script is you and me, boy. Time, he flexes like a whore, falls wanking to the floor. His trick is you and me, boy. Time! I can't ever read that without thinking of the way that he comes in with that line. Time! In Quaaludes and red wine, demanding Billy Dolls and other friends of mine, take your time. The sniper in the brain, regurgitating drain, incestuous and vain, and many other last names. Well, I look at my watch, and it says 9:25, and I think, oh God, I'm still alive. Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, like, think of the distance between, that we've come in a few short years between Changes and this song.
Kooks. Between,
you know,
kooks,
I mean, Changes seems like a kind of little fairy unicorn world compared to this.
Well, this is what happens when you fall into the abyss of, you know, popular music and you know, lots of terrible Americans rubbing their hands together at you. And speaking of Henry IV, Chimes, god damn, you're looking old. You'll freeze and catch a cold because you've left your coat behind. I take your time. Breaking up is hard, but keeping dark is hateful. I had so many dreams. I had so many breakthroughs. But you, my love, were kind. But love has left you dreamless. The doors to dreams was closed. Your park was real and dreamless. Perhaps you're smiling now, smiling through this darkness. But all I have to give is guilt for dreaming. Yeah.
Dreaming.
Which is really great lyrics. Also, just reading some of these lyrics since we've been doing this, I think he'd already started to use a bit of the cut up thing that you know, became so prevalent later on.
I mean, I think this is one of the strong, like, this sequence that we've gone through. Watch That Man, Aladdin Sane, Drive-In Saturday, Panic in Detroit, Cracked Actor, and Time. Probably one of the strongest sequences of songs we'll ever see on an album.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And it's followed up by The Prettiest Star. So
I'm sorry, just talking with you about this. I think Aladdin Sane is a much better record than Biggie Stardust.
It's strange, actually. Now that I don't know. Ziggy Stardust is to me a more enjoyable album, but
yes,
yeah,
it's nicer.
Yeah, it's happier in a way. Whereas this is just like fucking sordid. Okay, so we get to Prettiest Star, and then there's the cover of Rolling Stones, Let's Spend the Night Together.
Spend the Night Together.
Gene Genie, good single, I guess. Was it ever a single?
Yeah. It had to be a single.
It was number two hit.
Definitely
single.
Was a single, yeah. And of course, Gene Genie, I think it's play on Jean Genet, if I'm not mistaken.
Let's have a look.
A small Gene Genie snuck off to the city, strung out on lasers and slashback blazers, and ate all your razors while pulling the waiters, talking about Monroe and walking on Snow White. New York's a go-go and everything tastes nice. Poor little greedy. I think there's a real Lou Reed thing in this song as well.
Yes. Just trying to find Gene Genie in here to see if he...
This also sounds like Dylan as well.
It's a much stronger record than I think of it in my mind, actually. Now that we're talking about it and going through track by track, it's Yeah, because in a strange way, I feel like the backing band has grown. I feel like the Spiders are, I don't know, like fully formed on this album in a way,
Yeah.
in a strange way.
Well, because this was also new material. I mean, you know, remember that Ziggy Stardust was an amalgam of songs that were written at the same time as Hunky Dory. So they still had that sort of worldview to them. I mean, this record was clearly after Bowie had, you know, had sort of experienced fame, true fame for the first time. So
the wanker Peg describes it as what is he? But no, he's talking about the Genie Aladdin crossover. Bowie himself described Gene Genie as a smorgasbord of imagined Americana and my first New York song. So he had New York in mind when he was.
Yeah, that's why I think it really, you know, I get the Lou Reed thing, because it's very clearly, you know.
So yeah, and then we finish off with another kind of Garson piano kind of solo riffic track, Lady Grinning Soul, kind of haunting
and more big octave jumps, you know. She'll come, she'll go, she'll lay the leaf on you.
I mean, I think that Aladdin Sane will always live in Ziggy's shadow in the mainstream, because Ziggy Stardust is a very rock and roll record, and it's high
very
tempo,
rock and roll. Yeah,
whereas Aladdin Sane is artier. It just sounds artier, but probably because of Garson, the songs are a bit slower, and it's just a little bit less kind of sugar rush. So I think that for that reason, it will always be the, you know, as strong as an album as it is, I think people will always point to Ziggy first.
Well, I also think just, you know, if you talk about it in sort of esoteric terms, I mean, in Ziggy Stardust, there was still the implicit hope that sex could free you. You know, there was still the implicit hope that you could, that sex was still a form of transcendence. Whereas with Aladdin Sane, that Eden sex is gone. You know, the transcendence is all removed. There are no leper messiahs waiting to take you away in their starship. You know, it's all gone, and it's just what's left. It's wallowing in the ashes, and I think that it comes through very strongly. I just think it's an unpleasant, dark world, and
now we're talking about it. The, you know, if you go back to Soul Love and some of the songs, you know, which get towards that on Ziggy. There's a liberating quality to it, whereas Sex on this album is literally just a really fucking seedy blowjob with a with this cracked actor, you know.
And as you said, it's a trans. It just becomes a transaction in true American fashion.
So, just before we finish up today, D, there is the small question of pinups.
Oh, pinups! Yeah,
which a lot of people slate, and it's been fun to give the album kicking. It was a UK number one, as was Led Insane, as was Ziggy Stardust, I believe, three in a row he had. But a lot of people basically criticize this album for being a kind of cash grab. They needed to put something out while Bowie was hot. They were already raiding his old albums and repackaging them. They put out Life on Mars, as we talked about. They re-released Space Oddity again. They, you know, they brought out his old albums with pretentious liner notes, if you remember. But they still needed something Ziggy. So here's Ziggy on the front of an album with Twiggy, doing a bunch of old. Cover of a bunch of old songs that he liked from when he lived in Soho.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the whole album. But I do think that despite that, there are some. I've always liked the Here Comes the Night second track, because it's so theatrical and kind of, you know. I love it when Bowie just goes completely over the top, like on Fantastic Voyage. And Here Comes the Night has got a bit of that, I think. I like the Sid Barrett homage CMLE play. And in fact, that was my introduction to Pink Floyd when I was a teenager. I kind of discovered Pink Floyd through this cover. So
through the cover of Sid Barrett's song, yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a, I think Sid Barrett actually lurks on a lot of the early albums, as we talked about last time.
Mm.
Especially the kind of madness through line, you know, the stuff with his yeah. half-brother and all of that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see him coming back to Sid Barrett again.
Sid Barrett also was an interesting character in, you know, in, when I was talking about the idea of someone who had sort of ascended to a certain height and then it all disintegrated and they were just a shell. I mean, people forget Sid Barrett lived into the 2000s, I believe.
Yeah, there's that famous picture of him, like with a Sainsbury's bag or something.
Yeah, yeah, shambling over. That's how I picture him, just shambling there with a Sainsbury's bag or whatever it is. Yeah.
So I'm just seeing if there's anything else to say. There's a cover of The Who. I Can't Explain.
Yeah, there's a couple of Who songs. I Can't Explain and.
Anyway, anywhere, and a Kinks song. Yeah, Where Have All the Good Times Gone? Great song. And in the Buckley book, it's got a quote from Bowie. It says, "In 2014, Bowie penned the sleeve notes for a compilation called The Essential Kinks, and he wrote, 'I've never heard a Kinks song that I didn't like.'"
Yeah,
high praise indeed, says Buckley. So, Bowie was a Kinks fan. Sorrow was a single, wasn't it? Isn't Sorrow a single? That's usually the one people pick out as the highlight of this album. I don't really listen to pinups that much, but I do like Here Comes the Night, and I do like that cover of the Kinks. Those are my, and See Emily Play. Those are my highlights of the album, those three tracks. Here Comes the Night, See Emily Play, and Where Have All the Good Times Gone?
Yeah, Sorrow, good. I don't listen to this record very often either. I mean, I think it's a good collection of disparate bits, but it isn't a record really for me. I don't know.
Bowie did some other songs around this time, like Velvet Goldmine. That was a film.
Yeah, which was meant to be on Ziggy Stardust, but it was pulled.
I mean, that's a good song, Velvet Goldmine. Yeah. There's John, I'm Only Dancing, which was a single.
John, I'm Only Dancing, which is a very good single, yeah. I'm now looking through Recall One. Yeah. What do we got there?
There's some random single that I discover called Holy Holy, which I've never
Holy heard. Holy, which was another song that was meant to be on Ziggy Stardust. Yep.
So there we go. Anything else on Recall One?
Let's see what else is on there. Mono single version, single mix, German single edit, sax version, Round and Round. Time was released as a single in the US. I forgot about that. Paul's wanking to the floor. I don't think it charted. And Amsterdam is on here, which is a cover of a Jacques Brel song. I've got to look now. I want to know if
All the Young Dudes was another Bowie, but he didn't. That didn't surface until years later, apparently.
I've never heard his version of it until much later.
Yeah.
I've got to look. Time, yeah. So the singles were from Aladdin Sane were Gene Genie, Driving Saturday, Time, and Let's Spend the Night Together. It was released. An edited version of the song supplanted the release of the single Drivin' Saturday in the United States, Canada, and Japan. So they didn't release Drivin' Saturday in the US, Canada, and Japan. They released Time, which is very odd.
Mental.
Very, very strange.
John Money Dancing was an Aladdin Sane outtake, apparently. So. Well, there was an Aladdin Sane outtake version of it with saxophone high up in the mix. which is apparently superior to the 1972 single. You can get it on the Sound and Vision box set, but I'm guessing it's on Recall One somewhere.
It's on Recall One. It's called John, I'm Only Dancing Sax Version. Yeah. So I'll have to give that a listen because I don't remember what the difference is.
Of course, as I've established, John, I'm Only Dancing, a song about preferring straight sex to gay sex. Just like Suffragette City.
It doesn't say if it charted or not. I mean,
it strikes me that they really, really milked the success for all of it was worth in this period, because there's a lot of singles released from these albums. I mean, Lad Insane had what, four singles? Did you mention that?
At least 40. Yeah, Lad Insane had four singles. Yeah.
Look, David Bowie singles. What he actually brought out. Just going to look this up a second. Because, I mean, this is something that people forget about a little bit as well, is that the singles market and the albums market were actually two, they were always treated differently. And I mean, speaking about the Kinks, this is something that I was like, why didn't the Kinks sell any albums? Like Village Green was a flop, apparently. And it's because they were seen as a singles act and their albums were kind of mismanaged and misplaced and so on.
Right.
So in the 60s, they used to do it separately. And obviously in this period, they're much more in the habit of ensuring that the singles are on albums a lot more. The non-album singles were Holy Holy, Memory of a Free Festival Part 1, an alternate version of that song, Prettiest Star from 1970. Yeah. I'm guessing he re-recorded it for Aladdin Sane, right? Changes for Hunky Dory. That was the only single from Hunky Dory was Changes.
The only single from Hunky Dory. The only single from Ziggy Stardust, I believe at the time, was Starman. Starman. They did Rock and Roll Suicide in 1974.
Yeah, so then they brought out John I'm Only Dancing. Then it goes Gene Genie, Driving Saturday, Time from Aladdin Sane. Time, we just mentioned, didn't chart, basically.
Yeah, it didn't chart. Oh, no, I'm just looking. Yeah, it's got all X's.
didn't chart in any country. What
didn't
a surprise.
Chart anywhere.
what a surprise.
What a surprise, a song about quaaludes and wanking.
then they brought out Life on Mars. And just looking at the UK sales, you can see that by 73, to give you an idea, Changes, which came out in 72, 83,000 records sold in the US. Okay. By 1973, in the UK, Life on Mars sold 482,400. So much bigger sales for Life on Mars by that time. But it's from the same, you know, it's both from Hunky Dory, right? The Let's Spend the Night Together was a single, Sorrow was a single. Rebel from Diamond Dogs, which we'll talk about next time. Then they brought out Rock and Roll Suicide in the middle of the Diamond Dogs
in the middle of that, yeah.
So
I'm very interested in all the singles that didn't chart anywhere, so let me read them. After Time, the next is 1984, which charted nowhere. Rock and Roll With Me, a live version from David Live, charted nowhere.
Do you know the nickname for David Live among fans was David Dead? Because he's basically almost on death's door in that album.
Not in good shape on David Live, no. I mean, that was the absolute nadir of his drug experiences, I think. Then we've got Stay from Station to Station, didn't chart anywhere.
Suffragette City as well, didn't chart.
Suffragette City didn't chart. Yassassin from Vulture.
Who decided to release Yassassin as a single?
Yeah, Yassassin and Look Back in Anger.
I'm surprised Back in Anger didn't chart. It's a good song. I like Look Back in Anger. It's got a cool video as well.
Yeah, it got a great video. The Lodger had four singles as well. That's unusual.
who does it? I want to know whose decision it was to release the assassin.
The assassin.
Ridiculous.
God's sake. Then we've got in the 80s, Crystal Japan, which is a non-album single, released at the same time as Alabama Song.
Right. That Alabama Song charted. Wow.
Yeah, it charted in the UK at 23.
It's No Game Part 1 was released.
Oh.
Is that the one with the crazy Japanese woman?
The screeching Japanese woman on it. Maybe the single edit leaves her out. I don't know.
Didn't chart.
And that looks... no, Magic Dance from the Labyrinth soundtrack.
Oh, what a tragedy.
What a tragedy. The best song. That was his last song that didn't chart. Oh, no, there were a couple in the 90s. Palace Athena, a non-album.
I don't even know that.
Non-album single, I don't know what that is. As Dow Jones Index. Oh, I see. Released under a...
Yeah, the Pretty Things Are Going to Hell from Hours. I remember that album.
I didn't remember Hours. Didn't chart. No.
New Killer Star from Reality didn't chart. The thing is, though, is that in the later era, in the later eras, I seem to remember that those singles weren't really released as singles. They were just released to promote, like as a video to promote the album, basically.
Yeah, by the 2000s, singles didn't really mean anything anymore.
I think even with Black Star, he just released the video of it, and then it was like, well, you know, this is to create the hype for the album, and then the album charts and the single does nothing, basically. So it's a slightly different model. I think Bob Dylan did the same thing as well. By the time you get to Love and Theft and Modern Times and all of that, it's like what is called a single is just, it's just the one that's got the video, basically. So
right, exactly.
Yeah.
I remember buying lots of CD singles in the 90s, but yeah.
Yeah, I remember buying Your Woman by White Town. so there we go. All right. Shall we hit the super chats and get out of here? I have to. I'm recording my show with Pete Quinones later on, so I need to.
Ooh.
Get.
Yes, he's doing that whole series. I didn't know you were going to be one of the guests. So.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to air today. It's just on. You know.
Right.
I'm just. Yeah, and then you release it at some later date.
Scrump Monkey, how could you be gone? You missed Starman. You know, I thought you'd be here for that. Anyway.
Yeah, he's literally called Starman and the Boomer.
Yes. Miserable.
Okay. Do you know I appeal to YouTube about it? I said, while the dish may not be to everybody's tastes, I don't think it should be age restricted.
So. Amazing.
Before you
do that, I remind you also just of that, because I won't say the word, but I was scanning a recipe from Escoffier, from the translation of his Guy Culinaire from 1907, and he actually has one of those as an ingredient in a dish. So very strange. So that term was has a very long history and cross-cultural. I mean, Escoffier, you know, the great French chef, is literally putting those F words in his dishes.
Just answering somebody from the chat there, he did cover the Doors' Alabama Song. It was actually it's a Brecht song, obviously, but Bowie's version of it is mental. It's from like a Scary Monsters era, like 1980s all the time. It's just a mental cover of it. Way over the top theatrical.
That whole period is a bit schizoid.
Shinobi says, you talking to the Rolex wearing, diamond ring wearing, kiss stealing, wheeling dealing, limousine riding, jet flying, son of a gun. I'm having a hard time holding these alligators down. Woo! That's a Ric Flair line. And then he's put a link to a Ric Flair compilation. So there we go. Barrel Roller says, did you know that Styx Hexenhammer 666 did a cover of Rock and Roll Suicide? Okay, so there's a Styx Hexenhammer version of Rock and Roll Suicide. Can you imagine?
I've seen some of his musical works before, but I didn't know that he did covers of Bowie.
Is he any good? Or...
He's all right.
I can't find the Styx Hexenhammer version of Rock and Roll Suicide.
Oh.
So do you know what there is though? This is one of the worst things on YouTube. Let me just show you. Mm-hmm. This whole market. Let me just show you this. Reaction. Reactions to Bowie. God. Let's react to the fucking record. You twats.
I hate those.
It's just the worst. That is, I really dislike that. That culture of let's react live to, you know, one of the most famous records of all time. So there we go.
The sad thing, I don't know anymore, but there was a time when people made lots of money during that. I mean, there were channels with millions of subs, and all they did was sit there with a fucking gormless look on their face and listen to things they can't possibly understand.
It's the worst.
God.
Brent Taylor says, if you like upbeat piano rock, REO Speedwagon.
Oh, no. 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 Oh, God. That's right up there with the Eagles in disgusting music that I can't even countenance. Oh.
I am not familiar with REO Speedwagon.
Oh, don't listen to REO Speedwagon. It's just the worst. It's the arse end of the 70s. You just don't want to know. Oh,
I'm just dread to think now. What happens if I type in David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, or Aladdin Sane into Google? What horrors will I uncover?
Ooh, came here from Stranger Things.
If I just type in reaction. Oh, fucking hell. Talk about ashes. Look at this.
Look at
that guy. It's just... I mean, what could they possibly say? Oh, I listened to Aladdin Sane for the first time. Yeah, you're my takes. I mean, what are these people saying?
Here's my gormless face, you know.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I listened to this album for the what is the reaction? I don't understand what they're meant to be like. Why is there a mic? This has had 40,000 views, D. More people will watch their reaction than our retrospective. So what's the deal with that market? Why do people like doing it? I just don't get it.
I don't know. I think it's this parasocial thing where, you know, sort of miserable, friendless people, it makes them feel like they're, you know, sitting in a room with friends, you know.
Yeah, I mean, what's this guy going to tell you about life on Mars? Brilliant. Brilliant. Let's get his thoughts on the matter. Look at this dude. He's let's freak out to Moon Age Daydream together, shall we? What is this whole thing?
Most of these that I remember like looking at, they barely say anything at all. They just sit there with pulling faces. And
oh my God, look, it's not like a kind of cat video that you're just kind of. I don't understand what the face is meant to be.
I don't know.
I listened to Low for the first time. Here was my face during bloody V2 yes, Schneider. What the fuck?
we realize we're now reacting to reactors.
Yeah, we're reacting to the reactors, yeah.
It's strange because I remember those React channels. It seemed like a lot of Black Americans doing it. I don't know, maybe the demographic has changed, but the
Yeah, well, a lot of the ones that we just looked at looked like they were
Ooh.
black, didn't they? You know.
Ooh.
So anyway, Dee, thank you very much. We'll be
Oh,
back
was that all the
another time.
super chats?
Yeah, that was all there. Bowie very low on the super chats, but you know, Deepest Law goes like this. It's basically Deepest Law is subsidized by the rest of the channel. It's like an art.
In the art stream.
It's an
I mean,
art.
some of those Warhol streams have still never broken like 3,000 views.
Although there is the Andrew Marvell kind of
Yeah,
retrospective super
that's
chat
been
as well.
memed. That's been memed into popularity. Oh,
So
all right.
there we go. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dee. We'll be back tomorrow night where we'll be looking at the economy. Yawn,
It's the
yawn.
economy, stupid.
Yeah, no, we're going to be looking at the economy because there is genuinely massive inflation going
Yeah,
on.
yeah.
And Radlib, they're also trying to redefine the word. They're trying to postmodern their way out of the recession.
It's amazing. It's insane. I can't. Oh.
I want to look at a few other things that have been going on under the hood as well, like the fact that like loads of insane, when I say insane, I mean like full on, like Q adjacent MAGA style candidates are just smashing every poll in America
Yeah.
in the Republican primaries. That is hilarious to me. So I want to have a look at that because I think there is a lot of organized minority activity going on. And there's also been the whole Alex Jones and Steve Bannon thing, which we've completely ignored, but we should probably have a look at it because it is pretty naked political persecution going on in America. So
Oh,
we'll
yeah,
look at that.
absolutely. I think you made a tweet or something. I had the same reaction. Is it amidst all this, they're still doing their
Yeah,
shows. They're just
every single day. I mean, Steve Bannon, aren't you like, you know, being interrogated by the FBI? Yeah, that was in the morning. In the afternoon, I
yeah,
still do War
you're
Room.
still
It's just like it's
doing
just mental.
my
Nick S says this show is a reactionary react show, except without the content, and it's better.
well,
So there we
obviously,
go.
absolutely.
I don't think there's much reaction on Deepest Law. It's just a
Well,
straightforward
we
art
did that.
show,
We
isn't it?
did all those streams watching films, I suppose. There's a sort of reaction. But I mean, there's good reaction. There's Mystery Science Theater reaction, and then there's, an open mouthed black youth kind of reaction.
Yeah, indeed. Colonel Crayon says, for the Bowie stream, tweeted at you, life on Mars. So there we go. All right. Well, thank you very much for that. I'll go and try to quickly eat something before I speak to Pete. And I'll see you all tomorrow night. I remember it's the summer sale. I can't
You
get
need
enough of
one of those big octave, yes, gotcha.
know that was a real advert with Tim Westwood where I took that
No.
from. So that was an actual
Wow.
cam ad campaign that used Tim Westwood in that manner.
Oof.
But
Oof.
yeah, thank you very much, everyone. We'll be back tomorrow. Now get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.